here we are with Anthony Kwiatkowski, a.k.a. Bruins Network. He's done great work in you know, promoting the Boston Bruins prospects, Boston Bruins in general. He's a great analyst on Twitter and social media. He's got quite a bit of a following here, but he goes into a lot of detail. And one of the things I like about Bruins Network is that he's a thoughtful, smart guy who peels back the onion a bit. He's not just talking superficially. He'll post clips and he'll take you through why the player that he's talking about is making a good play, and he's got a real good eye for the game. So I'm really pleased to have him on the podcast here on the Scouting Post. And Anthony, welcome.
Well, first of all, thanks, Kirk, for having me. You know, it's been a little bit in the making here with you and I going back to when I first started, and, you know, I was getting my first shout-outs from you. But, you know, happy to be here and really excited to get going and see what we can come up with today.
Awesome. Well, let's open up here and talk a little about your background. I mean, you know, where for people that may not be familiar about you, I got to speak English here. You know, where are you based? How long have you been following hockey and the Bruins, and what got you into following the draft and NHL prospects?
So I'm from Cranston, Rhode Island, and you know, that's just outside of Providence for those listening who aren't familiar with it, about, you know, 12 to 15 minutes. I've been following the Bruins and the NHL since about 2006, which places me in sixth grade at the time. And, you know, I wasn't a big sports fan growing up until I got into hockey. And, you know, my dad and my brother were, you know, pivotal in that movement. And, you know, my brother was a big sports guy, still is, everything under the sun. My, you know, intuition came in hockey. That was what I was really involved with. And, you know, I just glued to the TV watching. So, you know, going into high school and going through high school, I had a lot of friends who were D1 hockey players in high school, and I went to every game, you know, watching them with my brother and, you know, all our friend groups on Friday, Saturday nights, driving all over, you know, historic rinks in Rhode Island, you know, like Thayer and Mount St. Charles, which, you know, up until a couple years ago still had that chain link fence that everyone knows. And that's when I just kind of started developing my love for hockey and, you know, following the Bruins more in depth. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I said that, you know, listening to 98.5 The Sports Hub and WEI and stations like that didn't fuel me to, you know, push forward and try and get my own prospect analytics out there and own, you know, analysis of Bruins hockey. And, you know, that's where I started. Then one day I just took to Twitter about 2017 when I was in college, and the rest is kind of history since then.
Now, what, you know, when I was a kid growing up, it was a lot harder. We didn't have the internet, didn't have social media. And so, you know, I was always more interested in the prospects and the future players. Cause I remember being younger and seeing a young Barry Peterson come in and just kind of being in awe of him. And I had heard a little bit of, about him from reading the Boston Globe. But what really got me going was reading in the early 80s, the Hockey News started to do the draft guides. The draft previews, I guess, is what the draft preview issue. I want to say the first real draft preview issue for the Hockey News that was not just kind of a small section in a regular issue that came out around May of that year in 83, I think it was 84, was the first time they actually had a standalone issue. And then I had every draft preview after that. And that's kind of how I got my start. I'm just curious, what about the prospects and the futures of the NHL kind of got you hooked?
So, you know, I think that the mainstream players that who are already established in the league, they get plenty of airtime, they get plenty of you know, FaceTime, and they just get plenty of dialogue. So what I noticed was that there was a void for prospects. And if you wanted to find out information about prospects, it usually just linked you to, you know, fan-ran accounts or, you know, the mainstream accounts. But, you know, they were more matter of fact. They were, you know, player X had Y amount of points this season, and he's so-and-so years old. But there was something missing about actually, you know, getting a good read on what these players might be one day for their team. And honestly, what really caught my eye was, you might be familiar with it, this place called The Scouting Post. You know, there's this guy, Kirk, and, you know, he was doing essentially what I wanted to do one day, and that's what really caught my eye, was because someone was actually giving a deep dive into prospects. And that's what was missing in Boston for me anyways. So from there on, I just started, you know, reading and reading and reading and seeing what I could come up with. And I just love knowing that there are young players out there who are, you know, legitimately just kids, you know, at their baseline, 18 to 21 years old. And I like the fact there is a bit of uncertainty involved to them. You know, you don't know what they're going to be, but it's kind of fun and kind of, you know, immersive to see what they could be. And will they hit their mark? You know, will they not hit their mark? What elements will they bring? What elements, you know, do they need to work on? I just find that really fascinating. And for me, you know, reading, you know, the New England Hockey Journal and, you know, the hockey news and all sorts of, you know, kind of prospect oriented publications, that's what's really got me going as well. And, you know, I think that just, like I said, being fascinated with what a player could turn into is, you know, what really keeps me going in that regard.
Yeah. And, I, you know, well said. I think one of the great things about the internet age and the current technology, or I should say technological golden age that we're in, is that you can now go and you can stream games and you can, you know, find, if you work hard enough and you have the resources to do it, and I know you do, you can watch games in Europe and you can clip those up and you have access to Major Junior, and, you know, there are more college games online and on television than ever before. And there are just so many avenues through which that you can do a deeper dive and actually pull up evidence and pull up actual tangible visual examples to support your opinions. Whereas when I first started out doing this, I was actually hired by the New England Hockey Journal in 1999, and it was a lot harder. I mean, you didn't have streaming to the capability that you have now, and you didn't have Twitter. You had internet chat rooms and message boards, and Hockey's Future, believe it or not, you know, started out right around there, the Hockey's Future message boards, and they were pretty instrumental in terms of widening your scope. So it's been great to see it evolve and change, and you've really, I have to hand it to you. You've done a good job of establishing that niche, and you're, like I said, you're building a following. It takes time. Doesn't happen overnight. And because you're Bruin-centric, you're not going to get as, you know, you're going to be somewhat limited in terms of the quantity of followers. But smart hockey people from all over will figure out if they see your stuff, Anthony, that you've got a pretty good eye and a pretty good read, and they should just want quality analysis, because you never know, some of those Bruins prospects might end up on their favorite NHL team if you're not necessarily a fan of the Bruins, but you're just a hockey junkie in general. So good stuff. So let's move on a bit. I saw you the other day tweet out a note about the 10-year anniversary of the 2010 draft. And believe me, I know, I just posted my New England Hockey Journal draft preview article from that. And it was, I can't believe it, you know, Decade and Charlie Coyle and of course, Kevin Hayes and, you know, Chris Wagner. And then Garnet Hathaway was in that top 10 that I wrote up 10 years ago. But one thing that jumped out at me was this in your tweet, you were talking about going to a draft watch party in Boston to see them select Tyler Seguin. Now, I was in LA watching it, you know, unfold in real time. But I sat there, I was kind of wondering, I wonder what the folks in Boston, you know, are doing right now or how they're reacting to this. So now's my chance. I get to ask you about that. So Anthony, what was the atmosphere like in Boston when you went to that watch party? And what do you remember? And what were your thoughts kind of surrounding the team at that time 10 years ago?
You know, it's funny because that was really my first Boston Bruins hands-on experience, because before then I hadn't even been to a game. And, you know, 2010 for me, when Seguin was drafted that summer, I was finishing up my sophomore year of high school, going into junior year of high school. So I was actually really young at the time. You know, I was just about midway through 15. My birthday's in November, so I was turning 16 as a junior. You know, I had just gotten my, you know, driver's permit and, you know, moving into my license. And, you know, we headed up to Boston that day, me, my brother, and two of our friends. And my brother was driving, as I said on Twitter, his pretty much a land version of a boat, the Ford Taurus, for, you know, the younger fans out there who aren't familiar with the average first car back then, which was something safe, big, and blocky, which happened to be a Taurus. But, you know, we were driving up to Boston, which is anywhere between 45 minutes and an hour away from us. And, you know, this was also one of the first, if not the first, kind of public watching, you know, party and gather for the Bruins. And, you know, you're picking in the top two of an NHL draft. That's a pretty historic, you know, moment for your franchise. And, you know, we remember going up, and when we got there, it was outside of Faneuil Hall, and, you know, we're young kids, so we're excited by, you know, being the big city. And, you know, to us, Boston's a huge city because we got Providence, and that's the biggest we got around here. So, you know, we get to Faneuil Hall, and they got the projector going. We're watching it. They're showing the highlights and clips, and, you know, they got the TSN board going, the NHL, you know, center ice thing going. Everything is happening really fast. Tons of people, high energy. You know, you have people outside, and it's a good summer day. And, you know, again, it's just one of those moments where you're just kind of in awe of your surroundings. And, you know, Boston fans kind of miss out on the element that other fan bases do, where, you know, you do have those watch parties and those outdoor type settings. And, you know, for better or for worse, but that was, you know, a new experience for me. And seeing just so many fans there, just high energy, high octane, super excited, you know, happy for what's to come. And, you know, there wasn't a big debate at the time amongst Bruins fans of who should they take. You know, it's going to be Taylor or Tyler. You know, it's going to be who the team picking before two didn't take. And it turned out to be Tyler Seguin. And I remember, you know, people were cheering and going, you know, mental out there when Seguin was drafted. And, you know, that's the first time in a while that this organization had such a prominent, high-octane, you know, can't-miss type player. You know, there seemed to be questions around previous picks, no matter who they were, especially in the first round. I mean, you know, since 2005, you had Matt Lashoff. You know, he was taken in round one. I mean, obviously much higher at 22, but, you know, the next year in 06, you had Phil Kessel, then Zach Hamill. And we obviously all know, you know, how the Zach Hamill saga went. Then Joe Colborn, another one. Then Jordan Caron. And now we're getting into, you know, that real can't-miss territory, unanimous, you're picking, you know, a star-caliber player. And Tyler Seguin comes up, you know, via good drafting and you know, good trading and good managing of aspects. It gets you into that, you know, top three pick. And, you know, Tyler Seguin was one there that you're just sitting back and you're like, wow, the Bruins, we're here at Faneuil Hall, outdoor, watching a potential franchise-altering player gets selected, and it's just, you know, a super exciting time in memory.
Were you familiar with other players that were being drafted that time, or was the focus, like, you know, pretty much on Seguin and the pageantry that accompanied that selection at two overall?
I was familiar with some other players there, and as you had mentioned, you know, Charlie Coyle was another one I was familiar with, and that's because a lot of my friends – growing up, you know, they played junior hockey, you know, around the, you know, Northeast region. And, you know, some of their older brothers actually played with, you know, Charlie Coyle and Chris Wagner. And so, you know, they were local legends around here, too. And, you know, Charlie Coyle, that is, was someone that I was also, you know, very kind of well regarded with, but not in the sense that, you know, like, oh, he's going to be this big star NHL player. It's just someone that I knew of through mutual friends and, you know, their hands-on experience with them and their teams and, you know, playing against them and, you know, those leagues and, you know, like, you know, South Shore Kings type deal. And, you know, aside from that, oddly enough, the only other player that I was like super knowledgeable about at the time was actually Ryan Spooner. And that's because I was just starting to get into, you know, the OHL, and he was someone that just kept, you know, coming up. And as I was reading on, you know, a little bit and, you know, immersing myself with the element of drafting, and when I was just starting to get into hockey, he was a name that came up, and, you know, the Bruins had picked him. So it just kind of worked out that way that, you know, there was someone else there that I knew of.
Yeah, I mean, the Bruins were fortunate with Spooner because he had a broken collarbone right after the CHL you know, prospect, top prospects game, and he had a good game, scored a nice goal toward the end of that off the rush, as I recall, watching it there on the NHL Network. And then he broke his collarbone. Like, went back to Peterborough and broke his collarbone, like, right after that. And, I think that's what allowed him to kind of fall in the draft a little bit, because he missed a lot of high. He did come back, I think, in time for the OHL playoffs. But I think had he played more in February and March time frame and continued to point and score like he was doing, he probably wouldn't have been available at 45. Those things happen. And look, you know, Ryan Spooner is one of my personal connections. I know him very well and got to know him exclusively through his time in Boston. And so I was glad that he was able to make a career of it here hasn't worked out too well for him of late. I know he's kind of bounced around a bit, but you know, one thing no one will ever be able to take away from him is that, you know, he was an NHL player, and he was with, you know, had some good seasons in Boston when it looked like it was all but over for him. And so full marks to him for kind of resurrecting his career when he was kind of stuck in neutral there and taking advantage of an injury opportunity to, I think it was David Krejci, if I'm not mistaken, getting banged up there at the end of the 15 season that kind of gave Spooner the opportunity to stick a little longer.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, I don't personally know Ryan Spooner, but what I can tell you is that, you know, people and fans and media are too often to, you know, throw a player in the trash if he's not, you know, a regular 500 plus game player. But you know what, if you get into that range of 100 to 300 NHL games and, you know, you were serviceable for a while and, you know, you made some good plays and had some good memories with your team and, you know, you had some good stretches. And like you said, you know, he replaced David Krejci in a time when the Bruins needed him most. And, you know, he centered that line with Pasternak and Lucic. And who knows, maybe Pasternak doesn't take the next step after that. Or, you know, maybe, you know, that has a trickle-down effect somewhere where, you know, things aren't realized until later, you know, potential or skill sets aren't shown with the right combination of players, and you just never know, you know. So I like to think of it, obviously, you know me, you know, I'm a pretty positive person, so I like to try and put positive things on, you know, these spins, and one of them is maybe, you know, Ryan Spooner might not have been, you know, the most successful NHL player, but he still served a purpose to this team, and, you know, he served a purpose to other players on the team. And, you know, for a second round pick, it's not guaranteed. And if you can carve out some kind of role, even for a short time, it's a success.
Yeah. Well, and trivia question, who was Ryan Spooner's Providence rookie year roommate?
Torrey Krug, correct?
Yeah, correct. And Jared Knight.
Yes, Jared Knight.
The three of them. And, yeah, I had an opportunity to, spend some time with that trio. And, it's amazing, you know, just some of the connections you make and the encounters you have. And, you know, one night you're sitting there watching Friday Night Lights, you know, with some young guys, and one of them saying, man, you know, I know I can play in the NHL. I know I can make it. And the next thing you know, he's going to be, you know, he's in line to get, you know, probably one of the most lucrative free agent contracts coming up for any NHL defenseman. And he's, you know, performed, you know, to an all-star level. So, a lot of credit to Torrey Krug and the way he came up through the organization. And, you know, I guess it, for him and the Bruins organization, it all started in a little Providence apartment with Ryan Spooner and Jared Knight back in 2012-13 when the lockout was going on. So really good stuff. So, you know, having followed the Bruins and their prospects for at least a decade, because, okay, it's a great starting point. You talked about going to that draft party and getting in on and Sagan and Spooner. More recently, you've become more that analyst and the influencer, online influencer, in terms of your opinions and people going to you to get information on these players. What are your thoughts on the players that the team, you know, speaking of the Bruins, has drafted or signed, or in some of the players they've signed as free agents, and, you know, their ability to go out and sign impact players like Torrey Krug and more recently Carson Coleman, and how do you think that these have played into the team's overall success since 2010?
Well, I mean, from a drafting standpoint alone, I mean, things obviously didn't look great for a little bit there with respect to the Bruins. But, you know, drafting isn't an exact science, as you know, and you know, as most people I wish would know more of, is that nothing's guaranteed in the draft. And even what, you know, the analysts tell you and what, you know, the big board says, it's just ultimately up to the player and what's inside him. But, you know, I think the Bruins have done a great job in recent years drafting. And I think, you know, that probably goes back to, you know, 2013 when things were really starting to turn around for them in terms of getting, you know, quality NHL players. And, you know, same thing with signing undrafted free agents. And you mentioned Torrey Krug earlier, and, you know, that was about that same time. And, you know, at some point you have to start looking outside of the draft to acquire, you know, players and get them in the fold. And it's not always going to be draft picks that get you the guys. And, you know, fortunately for the Bruins, they've done a really, really good job of identifying and signing guys who could possibly come in and make an impact at, you know, both the AHL and NHL level, ultimately the goal there. So, you know, you look at a guy like Krug and he's undersized, super skilled, but, you know, this was a period of hockey where we were transitioning into modern hockey, right? So you look around, you know, 2012, 2013, and the Bruins were in the middle of that, you know, transitioning stage between old hockey and modern hockey. And I don't mean old as in, you know, like the 70s to the 80s to the 90s, but, you know, there's obviously a big difference between when the Bruins won the Cup in 2011 and the style that the game was played right up until, you know, when the Bruins were falling out of playoff favor in 2015-ish. So, you know, you saw that hands-on kind of, you know, transition from, you know, big bang-em-up style hockey into more finesse and, you know, tactile and skill-based hockey. So a guy like Torrey Krug came in and just kind of exploded. We saw him in that playoff run and, you know, he came in against the Rangers and he was just dominating. So I think, you know, when you look at signing guys like Krug and, you know, Carson Kuhlman, you can't kind of hold stigmas against those players because you're getting them for free. You know, you're not spending assets on them, and I use free relatively because it's just money. But, you know, there's no asset, there's no trade, there's no pick. You just sign them and you develop them and you know, you hope that they catch, you know, that next kind of gear and just stick and go. So, you know, you mentioned Carson Kuhlman, but Carson Kuhlman is also another case study to what the Bruins are doing as a whole when it comes to drafting and signing, right? You know, he's another lettered player. You know, he wore a letter on his jersey and, you know, he's good with the fundamentals, you know, penalty killing, getting pucks in deep, playing hard, you know, body checking, positioning, skating. You know, yeah, skating and speed and agility. And, you know, if you have the mind for it and the IQ for it and the raw tools, you know, I'm a firm believer that you can be coached and developed, you know, in a hands-on sense to become even a role player, you know, at the next level. And I think that's what the Bruins are trying to do, and it's working out because, you know, they're not trying to, you know, sign these guys and make them fill monster voids. They're signing them to fill, you know, organizational kind of depth and needs in certain areas. You know, for Carson Kuhlman, it was a, you know, high energy, high octane grinder type player who can play in all scenarios. And, you know, you can throw him out there against anyone at any time and he'll be able to bring those elements. And I think that's overlooked a lot these days because, you know, when you hear someone's drafted as, you know, maybe a grinder or signed and, you know, maybe they have limited offensive potential, which let's face it, a lot of the times these undrafted players do because they're just that, they're undrafted. And that's not always true, but sometimes it is. And, you know, you look at someone like Carson Kuhlman, and he has a limited offensive upside. Everyone knows that. But he has intangible aspects that you can't really quantify until he's out there in a big moment, like, you know, game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals. Snipes a goal over Jordan Binnington. You know, that's kind of what they're looking for, is players who they can trust to go out there, you know, trust to be left with any role you need. And it's just a great team-building aspect because in big moments, those guys have always shown that they will show up. You know, you look at Carson Kuhlman, he was a winner at pretty much every level. And, you know, he won an NCAA championship. And those elements, if you watch him, you know, highlights of him then, they directly translated into the NHL and AHL. So, you know, I think signing guys who fit that mold and players that fit that mold is really what you need. You know, you need guys who are obviously grounded, but also have an element of you know, a bit of that next level they can take. And it's not always going to be, you know, the most skilled guy out there. It's sometimes going to be guys who are just really grounded in what they can do and what they can bring that elevate themselves to the next level. I mean, you know, look at someone like Noah Chari, another undrafted signing. You know, Providence College, I had an opportunity to watch him in public before I started Bruins Network. You know, that was a weekend event for me. And high school and early college was going to Providence games. You know, they're cheap, and I get to watch someone hands-on and then, you know, signed by my hometown team. Guess what? He's not the most skilled player out there, but he works hard, he's got good intangibles, and he plays the game the right way. And sometimes that's all it takes. And I think, you know, if you're a general manager in the NHL looking to sign prospects, the Bruins are a benchmark of the types of people you should be trying to sign and bring in.
Yeah, man, Noah Chari, just, I remember when I was working for Redline Report, Kyle Woodleaf sent me out to over to the a New England prep tournament. And he was like, hey, you know, check out this kid, you know, this kid that's on Kent, Buñuelos. Now, he was a year out. He wasn't NHL draft eligible till 2012, but he was tearing it up for Kent. And I was watching, and yeah, you know, you could see Nieves did a lot of things, but I kept getting drawn to this, to the captain of the Kent Lions, and he was this heat-seeking missile that was just all over the place, and he was hitting everything in sight, and he was scoring, and he was so involved. I was like, ah, man, that, and I, but I looked him up, and he was like a, I want to say he was a late 91 or 92 birth date, and for 20, this was, you know, back in 2011. That was pretty late to be playing at that level. But I was just like, man, I really like this Noel Achari guy. And, you know, he's committed to Providence, so we'll see what happens. So it's pretty wild that his career arc has followed the one it has. And he's been able to, you know, not only make it with the Bruins and play well, but take it to another. You know, he earned that contract he got from Florida, which, you know, you understand it. You know, it's a payday. They committed to him term and value, and he takes it. But then he goes and he's a 20-goal guy. Unbelievable. And he went on that one tear there. What did he have, like 7 or 8 goals or something in 10 days or whatever, what ridiculous it was. I mean,
yeah, two hat tricks and
two hat tricks,
you know,
and, yeah,
the 2 week span.
Yeah.
And you know, he's a local Ryan, you know, legend, obviously. And
Bishop Hendrickson, right?
Raised here.
Bishop,
yeah,
Hendrickson.
Bishop Hendrickson before he went,
yep,
to Kent.
Yep.
And, you know, he's from Johnston, which is, that borders where I'm from, Cranston, and, you know, obviously Rhode Island's small. It's like 25 miles by 37 miles or whatever it is. So obviously you can imagine growing up, you know, like obviously some of my hockey playing friends who went on to play at Hendrickson and LaSalle, which is the rival high school to Hendrickson, you know, they were friends with Noel, and, you know, we'd go out to, you know, the mall or the St. Mary's Feast, which is the annual Italian festival in Cranston. And, you know, we'd see Noel there, you know, walking around. And couple times growing up, I, you know, was introduced to him through a couple mutual friends. And, you know, even now I hear, you know, one of my good friends, John, you know, his mom still sees Noel's mom, you know, from time to time at the grocery store in you know, Cranston / Johnston, because, you know, they went to the same elementary school growing up. And, you know, it's just kind of crazy to see how someone can go from walking around town and, you know, quite literally walking around your local rink to, you know, being a story in national headlines of the NHL. So, you know, I obviously wish the best for Noel, and, you know, I loved watching him in Boston, and, you know, hope to see more local kids keep getting shots here and there.
No question. Well, yeah. And, that kind of, speaking of local and where you're from, one of the amigos, Dominic Tiano, as people know, knew I was going to be talking to you, and he was curious to know if the Providence Bruins AHL team, Boston Bruins farm or affiliate club farm team, was really as good as their record indicated. And in your opinion, did they have a real shot at the Calder Cup this year?
You know, I think that there are two sides to that. And the Providence Bruins faithful, they're just that. They're faithful. They're like Bruins fans. So they'll always tell you that, you know, the Providence Bruins have a chance. I think this year they were borderline contenders, but still flirting with that pretender line. And I say that because of Dan Vladar. And obviously, as Bruins fans know him, he came from that 2015 draft. You know, he wasn't one of the scrutinized ones, but he was, you know, obviously under the radar there. And you look at the Bruins and, you know, they went on that, you know, ridiculous 12-game win streak, and that's sort of what they're ending on, right? So, you know, they were first in the Atlantic, and, you know, their main competition there is usually is followed throughout, you know, each season is the Hershey Bears and, you know, the Charlotte Checkers, and the Checkers being, you know, up until recently the Carolina affiliate there. Well, I don't know what their process is, but, you know, I had read that they had moved and, you know, they're looking into moving different places around in the AHL. But nonetheless, you know, the Checkers are always someone who comes in and, you know, they play tough, and they're tough, tough, tough hockey players. You know, you look at a guy that, you know, won with them in Josiah Didier, who's now playing for Providence. And, you know, you can see that they just kind of go in there and, you know, they follow their reputation and their name. They are Checkers. And, you know, they played the P-Bruins hard, and they always seem to get the best of them some way or another. But in terms of actually going and winning the Calder Cup, I don't think they were going to win it this year. You know, I think the Milwaukee Admirals, you know, they were kind of a team that was definitely, you know, more intuitive, you know, in terms of actual, you know, contender versus pretender. You know, I think anytime you have a hot goalie, you can win. And I think that's why, you know, I'm sitting here telling you, I think they were more, you know, destined to fall back down a little bit. And, you know, I think having that goalie who can catch lightning in a bottle and just be, you know, miraculous at times, especially through a sample like, you know, Dan Vladar has, at some point, will it run out? Yeah, it might, but it could also go the other way and carry you. So I think depending on what Vladar was actually doing from a team standpoint and carrying, you know, Providence, I think they could have made a pretty decent run there and, you know, maybe been into the conference finals. Would they have made it to the you know, Calder finals? Will they, if there's going to be a continuation? I don't know. You know, their defense is shoddy some nights, you know, if we're being honest, because they're trying to develop some, you know, key prospects there. And we just saw one, and, you know, he's obviously been a personal favorite of mine and yours, and Jeremy Lauzon. And, you know, he was Providence's most sturdy rock of a defenseman over the last, you know, couple of seasons there and even this year. So when you lose someone like that, you know, a really dynamic, you know, game-breaking talent at that level who can just control the game based on, you know, his range, gap control, size, physicality, it's tough, you know. And then you have other guys on your roster too, like, you know, Urho Vaakainen and, you know, also Cooper Zek, who are trying to, you know, be developed and, you know, refined into players for the next level. And, you know, it's a developmental league. So you have these guys who are down there, and some nights they're playing really well. And, you know, Cooper Zek, some nights he's looking like Torrey Krug and Matt Grizzlick. And, you know, other nights he's kind of looking like Matt Barkowski. No effect to him. And you know, no offense to Cooper Zek. It's just, you know, some nights they have it, some nights they don't. And that's development. So I think anytime you're looking at a team like Providence, who's, you know, main goal over the last few seasons under the Sweeney and Co. regimen, you know, of really developing players and making this a one-stop, you know, development platform, I think, you know, it gets a little skewed when you're looking at expectations and what could happen in terms of winning the actual league. So, you know, I think they could have made a decent run, but ultimately came down to how, you know, their goaltender Vladar was playing.
That's great, great insight. You know, I've certainly come to realize this in my capacity in the USHL, where you have teams that are built to win championships, and you have teams that are younger and are built to develop players, and then maybe if they hold on to those really good young, talented young players, they might have a shot at a championship the following year or the year after. But I think the AHL is similar in that you might have a team that is loaded with some really impressive young, high draft picks, but they're young They're young players. This is their first year pro. And so if your team has more of those guys than the seasoned veteran minor leaguers and or guys that have been in the NHL for a bit but have been, you know, ridden the buses and been through the trenches of professional hockey and are experienced, seasoned guys, if you don't have enough of those players, you can be loaded up on these really sexy names that are, you know, that everyone knows from the, you know, from the draft and, you know, or they were really star college players, but they're young guys. And so the chance of actually winning an AHL championship is probably less than people think because they're just, they're caught up in the names. But if you don't have enough of those seasoned, capable, experienced championship level type of players to fill in the gaps and actually round out that roster, then you're probably looking at an early playoff exit.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you see it hands-on in the USHL in your current role, and obviously, you know, throughout the decades watching and following, you know, major junior and minor junior and AHL and college. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because at the AHL, what I've noticed is a lot of the times, you know, we're always focused on, like you said, the sexy names and the big names. And yeah, you know what? Some of them will be absolutely great at that level and they'll be able to come in and make a big impact. But on the other hand, it's also going to be players who also play a role and stick to that role and that formula that can really exploit other developing players. And that's something that not a lot of fans and media, you know, know critical, you know, kind of judgment to them, but that's something that isn't focused on enough is that in these leagues, everyone's developing unless they're, you know, veterans who are regulars in that league. So, you know, for example, it wasn't, you know, someone like Zach Senyshyn making a huge impact immediately in Providence, who was obviously a prolific scorer in the OHL. It was someone like Jake DeBrusk who came in and he played that, you know, two-way kind of TJ Oshie style hockey, banging bodies and, you know, kind of just being a bull on the ice, you know, like Matt Bolesky style in Anaheim, you know? So yeah, it does take the sexy names to come in, but it takes the right sexy name, you know, and that is more apparent in the AHL than, you know, maybe the NHL and those higher levels, because you see what the players are at that stage, not when they're developing and trying to get to that stage, which I think is a bit of a pretty big discrepancy there, you know, because at, you know, this current stage, if, you know, let's say a prospect is signed, you know, this season and next season he goes into Providence and, you know, he's kind of pulling a Jake DeBrusk where he's pulling it all together and he's grinding and he's making a huge impact. You know, you can kind of see right then what he'll be, you know, in a couple of years, just based on the kind of style that he's playing and looking at what elements will translate next. And, you know, you mentioned the AHL veterans and the USHL veterans and, you know, who's ultimately going to be, you know, that backbone of the team to kind of support these younger players when they get exploited. But, you know, if you're a sexy name, like, you know, even Jake DeBrusk was in some circles, you know, you have to have those elements too of those veterans. You know, you have to learn from those in real time, hands-on, you know, with not much turnaround. So, you know, I think there's a discrepancy there, and I know I'm kind of going on a little bit of a tangent here, but, you know, just to see what players, again, are turning into and what they have turned into, I think there's too much hindsight involved sometimes. So, you know, you look at someone like DeBrusk and what it takes to, you know, make that big next step, and look at Jack Stadnica, for example, this year too, a sexy name from the start. You know, people who followed OHL hockey knew there's something, you know, with this kid. And obviously Dom was someone who, you know, saw him hands-on and he was raving about from day one as a special type player. And guess what? He's doing the David Pastrnak type, you know, moves and flash and pizzazz that, you know, he had in Providence. But he's also playing that DeBrusk style of hockey, you know, getting in deep, swinging down low, covering your you know, assignments, not missing out, and just kind of mucking and grinding when you need to as well. And, you know, it's rare for players in the AHL and USHL and college to have those elements at a young age, you know, all at once. So I think, you know, having those kind of players is what ultimately separates you from the pack in the AHL. You know, same thing with the USHL and NCAA and any other developmental league.
Yeah, we talk about details and habits. Now, before we go to Studnicka, I want to circle back on DeBrusk because you mentioned him prominently. And it's what's interesting is DeBrusk was a fascinating player to me in his first year of pro, and I'm sure you'll remember this very well. Some fans may not, but he had a hell of a time finding the back of the net early in his pro career. He was getting a ton of shot volume and generating a lot of scoring chances. The puck wasn't going in for him, and there was, you know, the critics were coming out, you know, the internet scouts that just look at the statistics. And I can remember getting into a few quote unquote internet debates, and I'll use the word debate, in air quotes there, and rather loosely, talking to various people that were, you know, getting on DeBrusk, first round pick and he can't score. But, and I can remember talking to Jamie Langenbrunner about it. Bruins, you know, director of player development. And he was talking about how, you know, what made DeBrusk so impressive as a prospect for the Bruins, even that year, although early in the season, the puck wasn't going in for him, was he was doing all those little things you talked about, details and habits, skating hard above the puck in the right areas, underneath in the offensive zone, able to see and read and anticipate and get himself, find quiet ice, get himself into position to get pucks to the net, forechecking demon, physical, tough to play against, all these things that coaches love in a player. He just wasn't being rewarded statistically. And then, imagine that. And, but I remember this was around probably October, November that I was talking to Langenbrunner. He said, you know what? The thing is he's generating so many scoring chances. Eventually law of averages is going to kick in and he's going to start finding the back of the net. And lo and behold, he did. And he had a great, ended up having a great rookie pro campaign. And if he had, you know, had a little more puck luck early on, he would have had even more impressive stats as it stood. He finished, you know, pretty solidly. And then, of course, the rest is history. He used the following year as a springboard to establish himself as an NHLer. But DeBrusk is a great example of that, where sometimes you know, if you're not watching the games closely at the lower levels and you don't realize it, there's more to this thing in hockey than just scoring. And the guys that, even if the puck isn't going in for them, if they're doing something to contribute, they're reliable defensive players, or reliable in all three zones, or they have the habits and details in their games, the coaches are going to keep going to them, and it all comes down to the T word, which is trust. If they trust them, they're going to give them the opportunity to play.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's something that you and I kind of originally connected over in the first place when, you know, I had some odd 20 followers on Twitter or wherever it was at the time. But, you know, it's not about how many points you have in the AHL. It's about what you're doing when you're on the ice, more so than that. Yeah, the points are nice, but you know what? The points aren't going to necessarily translate to the next level. You know, you can't really control that too much. But what you can control is your own game. You know, your own mind, your own skills, your own tendencies. You can control that stuff. So like you said, you know, and I'm sure Langenbrunner is absolutely spot on with DeBrusk and everyone else. And he allegedly has a great handle on the prospects and the organization. I mean, the proof is in what we're seeing now with a kind of golden era of NHL quality prospects. But, you know, you look at someone like DeBrusk who, like you said, the goals weren't necessarily there. And you know, I remember it didn't come on until about January or December-ish for him. Yeah. And then he went on that big tear. And, you know, that's something to keep in mind, is that you're playing in the AHL. And when you're playing in the AHL and you're someone like DeBrusk, you know, you're obviously barreling towards the net and you're going, you know, straight through guys and you're cutting, you know, directly into players. And when you're centering feeds and, you know, you're centering the puck and you're shooting to create, shooting low for rebounds, other players in your team aren't necessarily as skilled as you are because it's a developmental league. So players are at different points and, you know, let's face it, some of the veterans there that you're going to be playing with aren't good enough to bury a lot of those high-end scoring chances, which is why they're in the AHL. But if you have those tendencies and you stick to them and you continue to bring it night in, night out and throw the stats out the window, you're going to get them at the next level. Because what someone like, you know, even Paul Carey, who's a good AHL player, for the opportunities that he can't bury with current players in the Providence roster, someone like David Pastrnak is going to be able to. You know, Charlie Coyle, Andre Kasha, they're going to be able to put that puck in the back of the net. Even Sean Corrali and Chris Wagner, they're NHL players with NHL tools. That's why they're there. So if you're playing an NHL-style game in the AHL, that's a good thing. And there's not enough focus on that for young developing players. And DeBrusque is one of them.
Yeah, no question. So, you know, Providence, you know, we talked about it. They've been the affiliate since 1992. Prior to that, they were the Maine Mariners in Portland, what later became the Portland Pirates franchise. I remember seeing a few games that inaugural season, and they had an unbelievable offense. I mean, Jim Vesey Sr. was on that team, but they had Joseph Stumpel and Glenn Murray and, Sergei Zoltok and Grigory Pantaleev and Andrew McKim, who was a young, high-scoring junior player who was really good. So Providence has had some good, you know, started out with a terrific offense early in their existence. And this year, hockey's different. You don't have the offense like you had in the 80s and in the early 90s. So this year, Jack Stadnica led the team in scoring. And you were kind of touching on him earlier. So let's, you know, because fans are really interested in Jack, what is it about him that just screams future and it's NHL success story to you?
A couple things. It's hard to really pick just one, but for me personally, from just like a analysis aspect, his skating stride and his stature screams NHL future to me. And it kind of screams like high-end NHL future. So when you look at Stadnica's skate, right, he's one of those players that is obviously very strong. He's slender, extremely athletic. But when you watch him skate, I liken him to the same kind of skating structure as DeBrusque and Tyler Seguin. And I say that because if you look at DeBrusque and Tyler Seguin and you know, Seguin specifically skating, he's someone that really has a strong core and strong lower half of his body so that he doesn't have to be, you know, fully hunched over when he's skating to get into that kind of, you know, high speed gear. He's a little bit hunched over, but his head's up and he's kind of a little bit, you know, angled upright so that he's really just kind of pushing from the lower half of his body. And it's just allowing him just to fly up and down the ice while remaining strong. And, you know, DeBrusque has that element too. You know, you watch him in the playoffs when he's really intense and he's really kicking his stride into gear. You know, he's really just pushing from, you know, his core and his legs and really utilizing that kind of, you know, stature that he has, that kind of taller, kind of slenderish, you know, athletic stature, but still super strong and you know, obviously strength oriented there. So I look at Stanika and he has an NHL stride and NHL stature right now. You know, he can carve in and around, you know, those areas of the ice that some prospects don't even know are there yet because they haven't developed that next level sense. So, you know, at this current level, Stanika's carving in and out of people. You know, he's angling off guys who have, you know, 20 pounds and 2 inches on him and some of the bigger defensemen and bigger forwards. But, you know, his stride and his stature, I'd say, are what jump off the page immediately to me when, you know, I look at him. And, you know, I got to tell people, don't just watch on stream. You know, I get it. It's not easy to get there in person. And, you know, it's not always financially, you know, cheap for you or, you know, financially feasible. But if you can spend the $20 or so on a secondhand ticket from a Providence, you know, vendor like, you know, StubHub or SeatGeek, go. Buy the ticket. Get there. You know, after the first period when you see who's actually, you know, in the seats and who's not, move up to ice level as close as you can. And man, does it make a difference seeing these guys play in person, hearing them. You know, for me, that's something that I like to do. And obviously, I'm credentialed, so I'm in the press box or press bench or I'm in the scout box. But, you know, in between periods, you know, I like to move around. And second period, you know, I like to go sit down at ice level as close as I can or, you know, down by the Zamboni side door sometimes if they'll let me there. But just hearing the way that their skates sound and, you know, not hearing any choppiness is also something else that just jumps off the page to me. And someone like Jack Stadnica, he's just pure in all those elements. And, you know, when you look at someone like Tyler Seguin, you see it immediately since that 2011 Cup run, just watching his crossovers, watching the way he accelerates in and out, you know, when he's pivoting, when he's mohawking, when he's doing all those moves to kind of transition himself and put him in the best possible position for any given transition on the ice, whether you're switching to offense or defense. You see it in spades with someone like that, and it's just something that jumps off the page immediately.
Another thing Studnik is famous for is his ability to play big, produce in key situations. You know, he was his draft season, regular season with Oshawa Generals, not that impressive, and he was trending down like maybe fourth round, fifth round, and then all of a sudden playoffs roll around and he upped his production, and then he went off to the World Under 18 Championships and was one of the best players for Team Canada. Talk about Jack Studnicka's ability to produce in big situations, his ability to score shorthanded goals and just kind of be that guy. You can't really explain it. There are guys that can score a lot, but they don't really impact the game. And then there are those guys that find a way to elevate and score those memorable goals or those crucial goals that actually translate into points and wins for their team.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Studnicka as one of those guys, and I agree. And you see it pretty much every night in Providence. If there's a shift that you need something, and it's not necessarily a goal or a point on the sheet, but you just need some sign of life, right? Your team's down. Maybe you're in the third. You're down two goals or one goal, or maybe you're tied and you're just looking to end it. You put Jack out there, and every single time he does something. It doesn't always translate. Sometimes he'll blunder it, or you know. He'll maybe sometimes try too much, but he's in control. And that is one of those elements that goes hand in hand with what you're talking about is, you know, your ability to control and dictate the ice, dictate what's happening and really just control it. And he's one of those guys, you know, on the ice with the puck, without the puck, he's always doing something little, something, you know, finite that is allowing him to dictate what's happening in front of him. And he scores the memorable goals. You know, he does. In Providence, you go look and look at him on the penalty kill, for example. You know, he's got over half a dozen, you know, shorthanded goals to lead the AHL this year. And they're all really, really high-end goals. You know, it's defense to offense. You know, grinder style hockey where you're paying attention and, you know, you're working on your details in front of you and you're converting them. You know, you're elevating them to offense and you're going to take the next step down the other end of the ice. And that's what he does. You know, he's in control at all aspects and all times on the ice. And, you know, you see it. He'll make those super high end plays where, you know, maybe an opening isn't there yet, but he sees it developing. He'll make that pass, and him and Cameron Hughes, since Cameron Hughes has gotten back from, you know, his concussion injuries and upper body injuries, they kind of connect like that in almost like a Bergeron and Marchand type way. And ultimately that's what you're looking for out of those players when you're drafting is who's going to be able to step up in big moments, who's going to be able to, you know, bring you the most bang for your buck. You know, and Studnicka has that, a second round pick. And, you know, we saw him with the Generals and, you know, we saw him with the Ice Dogs too. And, you know, he's out there in every situation. And I mean, he's just in control. And that's another element that obviously pops out aside from his skating and physical aspects is just how honestly intuitive he is on the ice and just how in control he is of his surroundings and elements.
Awesome. So outside of Studnicka, who are some of the players in Providence that you think Bruins fans can most expect to, you know, one day come up I-95 and maybe establish a regular address at the TD Garden in the future?
I think the most prominent one right now outside of Studnicka, and obviously we saw Jeremy Lauzon, who I've been along with you preaching about for, you know, 5 years now. We're coming up on that draft, and, you know, he's going to be an NHL regular. You know, there's no turning back for him now. The sky's the limit for that kid, and all power to him for working through it and becoming a regular. And he's someone that Bruins fans can now look at and say, you know what, he's going to have a permanent, you know, address here or somewhere in the NHL if that's, you know, what happens down the road. But I think Trent Frederick is another one right now that people should be, you know, opening their eyes to. And he was obviously a criticized draft pick. We all know it, you know, after – Trent Frederick, a few picks later, you get Alex DeBrincat to Chicago, comes up 41 goals in his rookie year. Obviously, you can debate the pick all you want, but I don't really care for that stuff, as you know, and obviously you don't either. So, I like to look at someone like Trent Frederick who can establish his own career and his own permanent residence in Boston or, an NHL city based on what he brings to the table. And we've seen a huge shift in Trent Frederick's development since he was drafted. He came up as someone that was obviously heavily criticized. And by myself, I didn't like the pick, obviously. I didn't have much of an outlet to discuss it. But in my personal life, I was obviously against it. I was young and learning then. And, I believe you also were someone who was skeptical of the pick at the time. And obviously, I remember that Scouting Post blog that came out, into his rookie year at Wisconsin, where it said, at the start, we got it wrong. And that's it. So, you look at Trent Frederick now, he was a point per game player in the NCAA. He was hampered by a hand injury that, you personally reported on, that the Bruins knew about, and no one, if anyone, knew about but the Bruins at the draft table. And now,
he had a hat trick with a broken hand. And I remember thinking, man, he doesn't even handle the puck. Like, all he's doing is going to the net with a stick on the ice. But he ended up, he had a hattie out of that. There's something to be said about that.
Yeah, and there's also something to be said about what he was still doing, with that injury. That's a painful injury. Anything on your hands, your digits, we've all been there where we've broken a finger or dislocated a finger or, broken a small bone in your hand, and it's a nagging, annoying, mind-boggling pain all day. It's like a thorn in your side. So I think there's something to be said about a player who is still bringing those really grinder and fighter elements, that won't quit mentality and that performance each night with such a, mind-numbing pain, night in, night out. So moving forward, with Trent Frederick, we saw him at Wisconsin, point per game player. I think he was off by one single point. I think he went, 65 out of 66 or something like that. So comes into Providence. And, I think that was 2017, 2018. But, he had almost double digit points in, a few games there, like 12 or 13 games. And, the next season, he kind of just took off as someone to watch. He had 14 goals in his true rookie season in Providence in 55 games. Mm-hmm. That paces you for, just about 20 goals, somewhere over that. So that is an element that has been more prevalent in Frederick's game, is that he's a skilled guy. Yeah,
He's a tough guy.
But you know what? He's also skilled. He can make plays and he can be creative. And most importantly, he can rip that puck, man. My God, can he just get behind it on just a wrist shot and almost beat any goalie clean? And we see it in Providence. We saw it all last season. This season, we've seen it even more, but this season he doesn't have the puck luck. He leads the AHL last time I checked in post hit. And look, you can say all you want about posts and hitting posts. And, some pundits will tell you that, it's a bad thing. And, it doesn't mean that they're going to be goals because, they could have went out or up or down or whatever. But, if you're beating the goalie clean and he's stuck there with his glove or blocker up, still trying to figure out what happened and locate the puck, he was beaten. So I think the law of averages will kind of kick in at some point, and posts will turn into puck luck. And as we all know, a huge element of hockey is puck luck. But Frederick had 32 points in 59 games this season in Providence, and he was also cold for a while, streaky, frustrated. You could see it. But since he had that streak where he was a point per game or somewhere around there, just bullying guys and dummying guys at fights left and right, I mean, he's just established himself as a dominant presence on the ice this year. And I think moving forward in Boston, now that he has that kind of more athletic, slender, kind of tweaked build in his actual, physicality aspect, I think that's something that'll translate to the next level. And I think based on those elements alone, even if he doesn't take the next step in the NHL as, a top six forward type, creativity guy, someone who can get the puck to his teammates, control the ice, dictate the pace, and just be a presence out there that people are generally scared of, whether he has the puck or not, because of what he's doing without the puck, which is obviously bullying people. Let's face it. He's just a dominant force. So I think that's one of the players that you'll see most established as a regular resident of Boston.
Yeah, you're right. I was a skeptic. My opinion started to change, though, when I was talking to people on the down below, Trent was doing we were waiting actually for Trent to come out. He had just been selected, and there's a waiting period down below where they're doing all the media interviews, and it's kind of a chaotic scene because all the players are moving in and out, and you're looking for that Bruins jersey, Bruins sweater, on the player, because they're just all the NHL jerseys are circulating through, and guys are in and out, and you don't want to miss the opportunity to get in on their scrum and get their post draft comments, because you're not going to get if you don't get them, then you're probably not going to get them unless you get lucky. And I remember David Quinn, then still coaching, of course, Boston University, and he kind of winked at me, and I said, well, what do you think of that pick? And he said, man, I love it. He said, I was competing with Wisconsin for Trent Frederick, and I was devastated when he chose the Badgers over the Terriers. So that kind of a comment, that kind of feedback, carried a lot of weight for me. I kind of said, well, maybe I'm not looking at this the right way. Maybe I'm, because again, when we're on the outside and you're not a part of a team and you're, it's easy to just sit there and watch games. But what you're not seeing the bat behind the scenes stuff, the practices. You're not seeing, you're not privy to the conversations that are happening. You're not around the player. You're not really seeing what hockey guys tend to see and the coaches tend to see. So Tony Granato's brother, Don was. Had also had coached him there at the national team and knew him and was excited for him. So you start talking to people and you start kind of finding out a little more, and I said it earlier, you peel the onion back. It's really easy to look at statistics and draw certain correlations. And look, sometimes you can look at the stat line and go, yeah, that guy's probably, that guy's not going to be a top six forward just by, just by looking at the stat line. And unfortunately I was there. I was there when the infamous quote was made by Keith Gretzky that, yeah, we knew he's probably not going to be a top, and again, in fairness, like I was there, I was actually the one that asked the question, that he was answering. And so the full context, of the question was, it was what you mentioned earlier, which was, hey, there were other higher rated offensive players, on the board at the time. What led you to opt for him over some of these others? And so Keith Gretzky was talking about fit, and he was talking about what's important to the organization. And that sometimes you're going to pass on a player that might have more skill and more of a quote unquote, offensive ceiling to take a player that is more the right kind of guy. He said at the time, we don't have a player like Trent Frederick in our system. Now, ironically, Trent Frederick was talking about his hero was David Backes. And the Bruins were a few days away from signing David Backes as a free agent. But at the time, that hadn't happened yet. And so, unfortunately, the Backes story didn't turn out the way the Bruins certainly wanted, and many of us wanted it to. But at the time that the Bruins drafted Trent Frederick, they didn't have a prospect like him, and they didn't really have a player on their roster like him. And so sometimes teams will look at it and they will say, this guy is a better, the old adage of, take the best player available all the time, no matter what, sounds great on an internet chat board. But the reality is, when you're trying to build a winning team and a winning organization, sometimes you're looking at those guys that represent more value to you and your organization, what you embrace and what you need and what you value, versus the popular pick that on paper and then in practice, as is the case with DeBrincat, for example, is going to score more. He's going to reach the NHL sooner, is going to score more. But, you know, no matter how hard Alex DeBrincat works, he's never going to be 6'3", 220 pounds, you know. And so that's a reality. And and granted, he has scored and he is a proven top six scoring forward in the NHL. And if you could all go back and do it again, maybe the Bruins might change, but maybe not. And so that was kind of my own personal journey with the whole Trent Frederick pick. And I'm with you. I think he's got a lot of potential. Who else are you liking on Providence, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. And I just want to touch on the comment by Gretzky quick, because I've been a big, criticizer of that. And, you know, it is better with context, I will say that. But I still don't think that was the right way to say that, especially during that time. But, you know, he's right. You don't have a player like that on the team. And, you know, you look at Frederick, and at the NHL, if he can play the same style he's playing in the AHL, I think they got something that could really change the outcome of ultimately a playoff run. You know, that's someone that can legitimately bully his way through a game. And if you got someone like that, even playing on the third line, let's say, and, you know, you're throwing him out there against, you know, second line players or even first line players sometimes, if you can keep up with them, if he's bullying them and you got your other guys going out in mismatches and, you know, he's just wearing them down, you're in, you know, kind of like a Tom Wilson light scenario, right? Yeah. Someone who can really just dictate a game.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, anyways,
well, I mean,
someone
and,
else
and I, just, well, just real quick to just to throw in too. And let's not forget, Frederick is twice the skater David Backes ever was, even in his prime.
Yeah.
And yep, that's
athletics too.
Yeah. The athlete. Yeah. I remember so one of those college coaches was telling me that he threw a 50 yard, like he just stood on the 50 yard line and threw the ball, like through the, through the uprights, you know, like it was nothing, you know? And so, you know, quarterback and football and just an unbelievable athlete and that stuff matters too. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I mean, we talk about player comparisons and the Backes one rang true at the time, but the reality is Frederick is, he's a different, like he's the modern power center. You know, he has all the tools, and the question now is, you know, can he put it together and add that production element? You know, he's come into the NHL, and he's proven that he can throw him at that level at least, and he can play tough and physical and get up and down the ice. Now he just has to take advantage of his opportunities and get a little bit of an offensive dimension going, and it looks like he's going to be a good player. But anyway, please continue.
Yeah, obviously all those elements are important. And, you know, another guy that – I don't know where he'll end up, but I think he'll end up, you know, being a serviceable NHL player somewhere, is Jakub Zboril. And he's someone that, you know, has obviously been heavily criticized, another member of that, you know, infamous 2015 NHL entry draft. But, you know, I gotta say, I was down on him at the end of last year. And then this year he just really came in and just started turning a corner. You know, from day one of this last, you know, AHL season that had an abrupt termination, he was Providence's pretty much most intuitive and you know, three zone guy for most of it. And obviously Jeremy Lauzon, who I mentioned earlier, you know, was that stalwart, you know, hard to play against guy who, you know, also played against three zones, but, you know, he wasn't one who was being fleet footed in transition and, you know, making those depth little passes that, you know, he can make, but that's not what he was bringing to the ice. Zboril, on the other hand, was bringing a lot of what I think Providence fans and you know, Bruins fans wanted to see out of Urho Vaakanainen. And it was really refreshing to see Zboril, you know, come in, you know, in great shape this year, you know, clear head, not taking, you know, as many stupid and you know, ill-advised penalties, but really just getting in there, playing solid hockey and making plays on the puck. You know, this season we saw a lot of what we saw going into the 2015 draft with him. You know, someone who can really rip the puck and be confident with it and kind of play for himself, which is, you know, a double-edged sword there, because we've seen him get in trouble with that. Obviously in juniors we saw it with the Sea Dogs, where, you know, some nights he would just be playing for himself and it would just be detrimental to his team. So, we saw that in Providence at times too, you know, throughout the last couple of years. But this year, man, he's just controlling the ice. You know, he looks clear-headed. He looks refreshed. And, you know, he's punishing to play against in the own zone. Yeah, he still has his moments where, you know, he fumbles a puck or makes an ill-advised pass or tries to do something, you know, too special or doesn't clear the crease when he should or as soon as he should. And those elements will always be there. It's just, you know, at some point you get a player like him. But you know what? I liken Zboril to someone like Colin Miller. Colin Miller, look, we all, you know, saw him go on to Vegas and be a 40-point defenseman. But, you know, now he's on, you know, his other numerous NHL team because over time you get exposed for your tendencies, right? And over time you get exposed for the player you are, not what you are in the moment. And Colin Miller is one of those guys who doesn't have the best IQ and doesn't have the best decision-making process. We see it every night. You know, he plays with whatever team since he caught lightning in a bottle with, you know, Vegas. Zboril is like that as well. He has obviously a booming slap shot, accurate, hard, on target, great skater. Honestly, one of the best skating prospects the Bruins have. And that spans into, you know, I don't know if you'll agree or not, but that spans even into the NHL roster. You know, he's just a fleet-footed, very, very highly skilled player. And his mechanics and everything from there are pretty sound in terms of, you know, physical things. But what wasn't always there is, you know, going into the zone. Where do I move this puck? Where do I have the best percentage of making a play? You know, the calculation in real time at that faster, harder-hitting level. But this season, he has it. You know, we've seen him make the plays, and you know, I've posted countless clips of him this year, and you know, even my buddy Mark Diver, who I look up to as a baseline of someone who's, you know, reporting the right way and has, you know, a really good hands-on element with Providence, more so than I ever could. You know, he's even come around on Zboril, he's been, you know, critical and you know, hard on in the past for making those mistakes and, you know, being someone who could or could not elevate his game to the next level. But, you know, he has really turned the corner there. And head coach Jay Leach, who I've spoken to and posted a couple quotes about, has, you know, said he's been their best defenseman for a lot of the season. And, you know, he's been someone that they're looking to take that next step. And from what I've heard, you know, personally from you know, not to go insider on fans right now, what I've heard from inside the organization is they really think he could take that next level and be an NHL defenseman. And I agree. You know, I don't know what will happen at the next level if, you know, those elements get exposed like I was talking about with the Colin Miller scenario. But, you know, he's put his head down. You know, he's put the ego aside. He's put the playing for myself aside, you know, elements there and kind of just thrown him in the garbage. And he's just been there to learn and show up and do the work. And he's pretty self-aware. You know, I got to say, talking to him and hearing what he's got to say, both on and off the you know, audio recorder and camera, he's with it, man. You know, he's a prospect that, you know, he's aware of his weaknesses and, you know, what he could work on and what could be better. And he just goes out there and tries his best. And it's all you can ask for out of a prospect sometimes. And we'll see what happens. But, you know, I think he's someone that, you know, can definitely carve out an NHL, you know, defenseman career. And, you know, also, I got a couple other guys there. And, you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts about Zboril now before we transition into that.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, you know, like at the time he was drafted, he made perfect sense. And I, you know, a lot of us said so at the time. Like, you know, it's revisionist history to go back after the fact and, you know, talk about, you know, Thomas Chabot and those guys, you know, some of the, maybe these other defensemen that were taken after, especially when, you know, he's on the same team, both on the St. John Sea Dogs. You know, at the time, I mean, Zboril was the guy who was widely viewed as, you know, in the discussion with the Werenskis and, you know, those higher tier defenders that were available in that 2015 draft. You know, Noah Hanifin was, you know, for the class of the draft and widely linked to the Bruins, you know, in terms of attempts to trade up to get him. But Zboril was not out of that discussion completely. It was the things that you were talking about that it sounds like he's addressed. And one NHL scout, who's a really good friend of mine, put it put it the best I've ever heard. And he was talking about, you know, that he's a player that he looks like a player all day long, but when it comes to the game within the game, that was the biggest concern he had about him. And by that, what he meant was, as an example of the kinds of things when you talk about the game within the game, Zboril has the puck. He's skating it up the ice. Instead of passing it or moving it, he elects to try to carry it out of danger himself. And forechecker gets in and takes the puck away from him. And Zboril's reaction is to slash the forward as he goes by. And now he's in the box for a completely undisciplined and needless penalty. That's an example of the game within the game. And when I talked to this individual and asked him about Zboril and the Bruins drafting Zboril, that was his concern. He's got to learn how to be, and you talked about, when you're talking about a player who's selfish and playing for himself, that's a prime example of that. So it sounds to me that like he's matured and he's cleaned that up. And look, I'm all for it. You know, you want a guy like that to be successful because he does things you just can't teach a lot of players, and it comes naturally to him. But if you're going to be a successful defenseman in the NHL, you can't turn pucks over, and you have to make the right plays, and you have to work, and you have to compete. So I'm glad to hear that it appears that he's turned a corner, and will maybe get an opportunity going forward to be that guy that the Bruins thought they had when they made him the first of three consecutive first-round selections in 2015.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, ultimately it just comes down to what the player can do at the next level. You know, sometimes guys will come into the AHL or you know, college as highly touted prospects, and, you know, they're great at that level, and they're just not the next level. And there's only so much you can control about it. And, you know, you're playing the draft, and it's a law of averages. So, you know, if you draft the guy who has the, you know, the natural ability, and you think you can coach him into a player that can, obviously, like you said, something you can't teach is that natural ability. And, you know, Zboril is as high end as anyone else. So if you can teach him how to use it, great. Not, unfortunately, that's just the nature of the business sometimes. Obviously you're familiar with that as well, and drafting, and, you know, there's only so much you can do about it.
Yeah. So who else do you like coming out of Providence?
So this is obviously, you probably know where this is going. Yeah. It's very polarizing. Yeah. Zach Senyshyn.
Yeah.
You know, from day one, it was
you know, we've talked about DeBrusque, we've talked about Zboril, like, we got to talk about Senyshyn, right? Like, we can't not bring him up. So go ahead. The floor is yours, my friend.
Yep. You know, since day one, it was a failed pick in the eyes of most Bruins fans and media. Let's face it. You know, unfortunately, and I don't mean to generalize or you know, really piss anyone off, but the critical thinking ability isn't always there for the draft. And I get it, because you know what? You can't sit there and sift through all of this stuff, especially on your own dime and your own time, especially if you're a writer or a radio host or anyone else out there who has a family outside of hockey, or, you know, you're not getting paid to do it and you don't love it. I get it. You know, you're going to go by what Bob McKenzie says, or what, you know, Pierre McGuire says, or LeBron, or, you know, right now Corey Pronman, or, you know, Scott Wheeler, anyone out there on the mainstream, you're going to default to them, and it's fine. Right. You know, we can't all be experts or, you know, we can't all be hands-on in that aspect. And we certainly all can't watch, you know, 68 games of, you know, major junior or AHL hockey. So, you know, you lose out on some of the prospects who could actually be, you know, good. Zach Senyshyn is one of those guys. And, you know, he was drafted off the board, obviously, and we all know who's behind him. You know, we don't have to get into that too much. But, you know, the Bruins went with the guy who was 6'2" at age 18, 17, 6'1", and, you know, around 200 pounds. And he was, you know, voted as one of the best skaters in the entire Ontario Hockey League. You know, if you're voted as one of the best skaters, and I think at the time it was, you know, the best skaters in his entire conference, nonetheless, that's an accolade by itself, right? You know, that's a prized award to have. So that's saying something alone, that the Bruins picked this guy and he still got criticized, even though the natural talent was clearly there. So, you know, obviously we know the history there, but, you know, he gets drafted and heavily criticized, then what happens? He goes to be a back-to-back 40-goal scorer, and, you know, Bruins fans and media don't want to hear it because it doesn't sell and it's not, you know, polarizing, but he proved his worth as a first-round pick in my book. He did what he was supposed to do at that level, and if you don't pan out the next, you know, AHL or NHL level for any prospect of that matter, there's only so much you can do about it, right? It'd be the same thing as drafting a high-end player like Jared Knight. He doesn't pan out. He can't stick. You know, Zach Hamill, another good example. Someone up there who just doesn't pan out. You know, Pavel Zacha in that same draft. Not the player that people thought he was going to be. Mm-hmm. At some point, you can only do what the player is going to do at the next level, and, you know, that happens. But in terms of Zach Senyshyn, he came into Providence, and let me just say this for anyone who is unfamiliar with just how undeveloped he was then. He had almost no dimension besides taking the puck from about the neutral line, you know, neutral zone in, and just ripping it on that. You know, trying to go to the outside and turn defender, and it does not work at this next level. It just doesn't. You know, you got prospects of all different ages and players of all different ages. You know, you got men, not boys, out there. And at some point, you got to start adding other elements to your game, especially playing for an organization like the Boston Bruins that focuses on details, details, details. Senyshyn, you know, didn't have the points that people wanted him to have, and, you know, he didn't have the goals, and, you know, I always see, oh, well, he can't play in the top six. His own coach isn't even putting him there. Like, how can he do this? How can he do that? Like, he's obviously a bust. Look, the kid came in to Providence as a rookie and scored 12 goals in 66 games. That's not that bad. That's actually pretty good considering that you're, you know, in the bottom six, right, with minimal power play time, if any. So I'm impressed by that alone, and I think if, you know, his name wasn't Zach Senyshyn, more fans would be pretty reasonable with that. Next season, he increases his goal totals by two. You know, he gets 14 goals in 66 games, same amount, couple less assists, but nonetheless, all while being oriented, you know, in a two-way mindset where they're teaching this kid a two-way game from the ground up. You know, you can liken it to trying to teach a grinder like, you know, Anton Bleed the skills that Senyshyn had in juniors. It's more dramatic that way, but that's in essence what it is. It's a dramatic change and a dramatic turnaround. You know, Senyshyn had one role with the Sioux Greyhounds, and it was go out there and put the puck in the net for us. You know, we want to win. We want to go on. We want to win the Memorial Cup. We got a chance to do it. You're playing this role. You're barreling through the right side, and you're going wide, cutting in, and you're going to beat the goalie in whatever way you can, which he could because he had those natural elements at that level. Doesn't have them at the next level because you need those other aspects of two-way hockey. Now, starting last season, about halfway through, we see this transition to where he's really becoming quite literally a two-way forward in front of our eyes. He's playing three zones. You know, he's not just trying to take the puck and, you know, blow it by goaltenders. He's backhanding it through the crease, you know, selling a fake shot and, you know, dishing it to his line mate. Or, you know, he's using his speed to not just beat a defender, but beat a defender on the rush to a loose puck behind his own net and instantly throwing it backwards into the slot. And it gets uncapitalized because, look, he's playing with other third-line type guys like Anton Bleed or Brendan Woods for the most part. And those guys just, I mean, no disrespect to them, aren't skilled enough to react and, you know, put those opportunities home like an NHL player would. So when looking at Zach Senyshyn, we saw it at the end of last year, right? He came up for two games, and everything I just said, you could see. You know, he drew praise from pretty much every writer who criticized him, you know, every outlet that criticized him, in obviously a small sample, but, you know, the kid could play. He showed that he could play, and he could play, you know, a two-way style of hockey, maybe better designated to the third line versus second or first, obviously. But again, that's a fast, hard to play against big winger with size who can play in every zone. And that's how you complement a line, you know. That's how you complement a Charlie Coyle-type center. Someone just like that with similar physical attributes who can think the game at your level and ultimately complement the way you're playing. So Zach Senyshyn's not going to be a star player. It's just the way that it's going to be. but I see no reason why he can't be a solid middle six winger who brings two-way elements, speed, you know, kind of like a double-A type player from Detroit. You know, that's a guy who Dom has likened him to before. And, you know, we saw it this year. Senishin, you know, gets up, gets called up, and for four games, he was a pretty damn good hockey player. Unfortunate injury, unfortunate, you know, rule change in the NHL where you can, you know, essentially call back goals for, you know, fractional, marginal things don't matter. And, you know, that kind of screwed him on one where he made a really nice play to Charlie Coyle, and, you know, that should have been another assist for him. But, you know, in Providence this year, I think he's been one of their best forwards. And Jay Leach has been extremely high on him as well. And, you know, his teammates have been very high on him. You know, if you're watching the Providence games all season long, you look at Zach Senishin, and he's someone who's out there doing the little things, making the plays, you know, digging the puck out of the board and getting it to a free player. And, you know, fans don't want to hear it because they want to see what, you know, Matt Barzal's doing and Kyle Connor, and great, good for them. They're great hockey players. They will be for their career, all power to them. Doesn't mean that Zach Senishin can't be a fully useful, you know, three-zone player for the Bruins who comes in and compliments a player at cheap money when, let's face it, this team has a lot of high-end talent that's got to get paid at some point. And, you know, filling in guys and, you know, plugging holes and just putting these guys in positions to complement other, you know, higher-paid players is also a good team-building aspect. It's not talked about enough because everyone suffers from, you know, whataboutism, you know, so and the shiny tools and, you know, the shiny toys and the newest thing. It's not Zach Senishin. You know, it's the Matt Barzals of the world, the Kyle Connors, the Konechnys, and, you know, the Brock Bessers. But you know what? Those guys, who knows what they'll do when they're faced with, you know, adversity like Senishin is and he's trained to deal with now, you know, where he can get behind the net and maybe dislodge a loose puck on his, you know, on his stick from diving and, you know, making the utmost selfish, you know, selfless play. And we've seen that this season. You know, I've seen him, you know, dive to get a puck out on the clear and it works. You know, I've seen him break through and use his speed and set up multiple two-on-ones that are just unanswered because the guys he's playing with can't capitalize. And you know what? What happens? He gets called up to the NHL and he puts people right in their place, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, that's a pretty good, breakdown. Again, you know, goes back to you're not always looking for the best, the quote unquote best players or the most talented players. You're looking for the right players. And yeah, look, I mean, player per foot per player, you know, Barzal, Connor, Konechny, all those guys, you know, and there's a few Besser. They're more successful NHLers. And my point has always been, okay, they didn't take the guy you wanted. At what point are you going to move on and focus on the guys that they did? And I know, you know, some people, they just, they view that as a cop-out. And listen, Senishin was a, you know, he was, as you said, an off-the-board pick. He was a risky pick at the time as a player who was far more raw and less established and less polished than those other players. But the Bruins went with who their scouts were passionate about, and they saw a higher ceiling and a better Boston Bruins type guy who embraces their culture and their values as an organization, and they went with it. And so, you know, the door is not closed, certainly, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next for him. As you said, it's unfortunate the circumstances by which you know, his Boston stint ended, but you have to be an obtuse tool who just wants to be a contrarian and just, you know, wants to be right more than be happy for the success of your team to sit there and insist that, you know, that he's a bust at this stage of the game. And yeah, that's just the way it is. But
and good breakdown. You know, it's not always about just, you know, if a player's a bust because, you know, maybe he goes on to be a 10 to 15 goal, you know, 30 point speedy player, you know, because someone behind him is a 60, 70, 80 point guy. It doesn't make one a bust just because of that, you know? And that's something that isn't really hammered home enough, I don't think, personally. So looking forward to, you know, Senishin and what he brings to the team, I know Zach personally. Obviously, I've, you know, developed a somewhat decent relationship with the kid in Providence, and no one's happier than him around the rink. You know, he shows up and you ask him, he says the right things, he does the right things. The coaches love him because he's just willing to work. He wants to work. And most importantly, he does not care about the past, does not care about what he did in juniors, doesn't care about, you know, what other guys are doing. He just genuinely wants to help the team in any capacity. Doesn't care what line, doesn't care about his ice time. He's trying to bring the same game each night, each line, each combination, each scenario, everything. So, you know, you look at that and that's what's going to get you into a team like Boston. And you know what? I think he could play right now in the NHL full time with the Bruins on the third line next to Coyle and be an impact player in that role. I really do.
Awesome. Awesome. So you mentioned it earlier. You were talking about the different outlets out there and people who, you know, are rating the prospects, and you mentioned a few names, and let's kind of look at that, because, you know, the last couple of years, at least in the last couple of summers, you know, once Boston's higher end young guys graduated the team and they're no longer counted as prospects and they're no longer seen in the organizational rankings, you look at these every summer, you know, the outlets are publishing, you know, here are the 31, you know, NHL teams and where they stack up in terms of their prospects and their futures. And so, you know, whether we're talking Hockey News, we're talking Athletic, McKean's, you know, what have you, the Bees are now consistently down in the bottom third of those organizational rankings of the last couple of years, closer to 31 than 20, I would add. You know, what are your thoughts on the organizational depth and strength of the Bruins as a whole? And maybe comment on what you think some of those prognosticators might be missing, because unlike you, and I can relate to this, it's the same thing. You and I, we're focused on one team, so we know we have the depth of the prospects covered, and we know more about the middle to the bottom end guys that could end up, a few of them, really coming up and becoming contributors at the NHL level and doing much better than the typical larger pundits and analysts and observers out there can even understand, because they just don't have the time to devote like you do, because you're just focused on the Bruins. So where do you think, you know, might be there, because they can't, that people aren't aware of, because they're not able to do a deep dive into the Boston prospects like you can?
So, you know, I think that it's completely fair to, you know, rank the Bruins the way they are based on, you know, your metrics. And unfortunately, you know, like you just said, it only comes down to, you know, how available you are to study all these prospects. And let's face it, no one can study all of them. You know, I try and do my best with, you know, all teams' prospects and all, you know, all players coming through and, you know, where they're playing, because, well, this is all I do. You know, I come home and
you're a better man than I am.
Yeah.
I never tried that. So, I said, you know what? I don't have the time. I'll look at them in the draft year. And once they go on to other teams, I kind of would lose the bubble. So that's, you know, more power to you. It's very difficult. And that's why I have a lot of respect for those guys, because it is exceedingly difficult to track 31 teams worth of guys. But I also took pride in my niche, because when it came to breaking down the Bruins and what they had, there weren't many that were doing that. So,
yeah. And, you know, I think, like I said, it's completely fair to judge the Bruins system on what it is, but, you know, there's context missing there. And, you know, for starters, Bruins fans get all bent out of shape about it, because what a lot seem to, you know, not realize is the U24 talent has already been graduated to Boston. And if these guys were here right now in the AHL, the Bruins would be bar none the best in the league. You know, you got Charlie McAvoy, David Pastrnak, Jake DeBrusk, Matt Grizzly. You have all those young guys out there who are contributing at a high level, you know, first line, second line, you know, first pair, second pair. So, you know, those are players that are going to come in, and, you know, look at Brandon Carlo too. If those guys who are all, you know, U24-ish, except for, you know, Grizzly, if those guys were around the AHL right now, like some of the other highly touted prospects, I don't think it would even be close to who has the best, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that right there is an element alone. But, you know, to your point, elements that are missed out on, you know, when you're generalizing prospects and, you know, prospects pools for other teams is things outside of production. And you know, let's face it, when you're looking at 31 teams in the NHL and, you know, hundreds of prospects, you have to default to some metric, right? And production will always be there because, well, that's the most time-tested one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, goals and assists and points at any level. You know, you see pretty much that's the one stat that you look at, and over time that seems to follow the prospects most. But what you miss out on is things that I just said, like what are players doing without the puck? What kind of tendencies are they developing in the, you know, AHL, like Jake DeBrusk did and Zach Senyshyn is doing now, that will translate to the next level, but also complement the players that are out there in the NHL already established. So, you know, when you look at Zach Senyshyn this year, you see 7 goals in 42 games, which is half of what he had last year. And you're like, wow, what happened? Well, you know, goals are inherently random and you never know when they're coming, but, you know, you just try and put yourself in the best position to score the goals the most amount of times on the ice through your tendencies and your traits and, you know, your characteristics. And that's what someone like DeBrusk did, and it translated. So I think, you know, if you can't watch all of these players in-depthly and follow them one by one like I can because I don't do anything else or I just follow one team, you know, it's overlooked. And I think it's tough to quantify a player's rank versus what they'll do for your team, right? Yeah. You know, how do you rank a how do you rank a guy like Carson Kuhlman, you know, well under someone like, let's say, Urho Vaakanen, for example, at his best, you know, in the Stanley Cup Finals or the Stanley Cup playoffs or down the stretch, who's going to be able to give you more? You know, that's something that I look for when I'm evaluating a prospect, and it's not just the production. You know, I'm looking for who's going to be able to do the most for your team and your ice time and in your opportunity and, you know, with ultimately on your own, you know, with little guidance. So how do you rate someone like that? You know, how do you rank, you know, maybe a pure, you know, for example, Axel Anderson, you know, I believe Pronman or Scott Wheeler, one of those two gentlemen from The Athletic, had, you know, Anderson at number 11 on the Bruins. And then they had, you know, someone like Jeremy Lauzon as a depth guy. And, you know, that's taking your, you know, high end, you know, puck moving potential, but at a much lower success rate to someone like Lauzon, who is, yes, he doesn't have those super high end puck skills, although he's not a plug by any means. He can score, he can shoot, he can pass, but, you know, he doesn't have those high end puck moving elements that, you know, someone like Grizzlick or even Axel Anderson has in his most raw, unrefined form. But how do you rate, you know, that potential over the ability to physically and quite literally dictate a game based on just being a bigger, better defenseman than other players? So, you know, I think points go so far, you know, who you're playing with, power play ability and penalty kill ability, that stuff is obviously nice, but, you know, you have to look at their tendencies and what they're doing in big moments, what they're doing in the penalty kill, you know, looking at what they will be able to contribute if they're not scoring, ultimately. You know, one of the most recent prospects who's quite frankly listed highly with the Bruins is Johnny Beecher, as we all know. You know, but behind him went Arthur Kaliev, and he's another dynamo, you know, a catalyst, someone who's a 50-goal scorer every season without even thinking. It just finds the back of the net. But, you know, this is a good comparison for just generally looking at prospects and how to evaluate them. When they're not scoring and they're frustrated and they're going through dry spells, who's going to give your team most? You know, who's going to give them the most you can in those scenarios and you know, under those circumstances? Someone like Johnny Beecher or someone like Arthur Kaliev? Me personally, I think someone like Johnny Beecher will be able to. You know, and the same thing goes for a Trent Frederick versus a DeBrincat from another system if you're evaluating those prospects, right?
Yeah.
Who's going to be able to help your team most consistently when they're not scoring, you know, and against competition, and who can shut down the opposition, and, you know, who can contribute in other areas? And I think that's lost And I think that's one of the main lost elements when evaluating so many, bulk prospects for different teams. Because, yes, someone like Jack Sidnicka should be number one on the Bruins, circuit. But someone like, Trent Frederick should also be high up there as well, even though the offense isn't there, because without the puck, they can both dictate the game pretty damn well. And I think Frederick comes pretty close to being able to dictate the game like Sidnicka can without the puck. You know, just positioning and defense and structure and wearing the other opponent down just by your intellect and ultimately your abilities outside of scoring. So, I think it's completely fair to rank prospects the way that these gentlemen and these women do. And, I don't knock them necessarily for that. It's just, to say one player indefinitely is better than another without, annotating like I just did. You don't ever see those parameters, listed out there. You never see the footnotes to say, oh, well, just because Zach Senyshyn had 7 goals this year doesn't mean he can't be a full-fledged, useful NHL player. It just is a number.
Yeah.
And then fans and media roll with that, and it just creates chaos. And I feel bad for the players mostly because a lot of them are trying their hardest and they are increasing, their odds to get to the NHL, like you said, by becoming a, multi-tool player like Senyshyn or, Frederick or anyone else out there.
Yeah, well, it's a star power ranking, right? And so the first, you know, you talked about the production that they default to, but they also default to draft position. Where's the guy drafted? What kind of hype did he have coming in? So, a lot of these organizational rankings turn into a who has the most highly touted draft pick. And occasionally you'll get these players that were maybe drafted later on, but they really pop and they're really high end. And again, then you're defaulting back to the production thing. So just a couple points you made that I thought were outstanding that I want to touch on. And then I want you to get into our man, John Beecher, in a little more detail. You hit the nail on the head. You said something that is so important, and I can't stress this enough because I've heard this from college coaches. I've heard it from high-level junior coaches, and there's no doubt that holds true in the NHL, and that is this. Now, do you even know you made a brilliant point? Of course you did, but I'm gonna highlight it because I cannot overstate this enough. You said when you are not scoring, you better be able to, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you better be able to do something else, impact the game, provide, bring something else. That if the puck is not going in the net for you or you're not setting up people, then you better be doing something. Because if your offense dries up and you're just a one-dimensional, and this goes back to the point you were making between Beecher and Kaliev, if the puck's not going in for you, but that's all you do, and the coach has a choice to play you or a guy that brings a reliable, trustworthy, all-around game, that other guy is going to get the ice time if you're not scoring. And so that is so important. And, it's not sexy. It's not going to sell tickets in a lot of cases. Most people want to be brought out of their seat. They want the electricity. And look, it's understandable. Winning hockey organizations and cultures and winning coaches know that there are certain trustworthy elements to players that will result in them getting the opportunities when it matters the most. And I say this to players when I'm talking to them and recruiting them or, it's talking to them, giving them feedback. And I say, I always bring up the T word. And the T word isn't teamwork, it's trust. And you earn the trust of your coach because every player who's worth a damn wants to be on the ice in the final minutes of a game. Whether you're down a goal and you're holding the lead, you're down a goal and you're trying to find that equalizer, or you're holding the lead and you're holding on for dear life. Every single player wants to be tapped on the shoulder and put out there in those key situations. And you know what? If a kid's a healthy scratch and he's out of the lineup, and he's happy about it and he's content to sit up there eating popcorn, watching the game, I don't want that guy on my team. So I want guys that are upset if they're not being given, or if they're out of the lineup as a healthy scratch because they need to take time to watch a game and observe and see what they're not bringing, enough to warrant being in the lineup that night. Because, it is a privilege to play for any team at a high level. It is not a right. And sometimes good players get sat down and they have to watch as a healthy scratch. And I don't want anybody that's content up there, but by the same token, they got to put the sullenness and the woe is me aside and understand what it is they need to do And oftentimes the guys that are sitting are the ones that think that it's all only about scoring and they haven't embraced the idea of playing a complete game. So went on a little bit of tangent there, but you're 100% right. And if just a few people listening to this can kind of take that perspective and go, oh yeah, okay. You know, it's not just about the flash and the excitement and the one-dimensional stuff, because at the end of the day, I think the Bruins do a really nice job of identifying who fits, who's going to embrace their culture and enhance their culture and make them a better team and replace those pieces and actually upgrade those pieces that go out. And we have a limited window for their core to continue to win a lot of hockey games. So the Bruins are going to have to address core pieces at some point, but I think they're doing a great job of bringing in guys that have a chance.
Yeah. I agree. And it's just something that, you know, the average fan and you know, the regular writer for your, you know, local publication or local radio show or, you know, local, you know, TV news station just doesn't really, I shouldn't say they don't care about it, but you know, from a business standpoint, that stuff doesn't sell. You know, promoting a Johnny Beecher type pick over someone exciting, like you said, like Kaliev, isn't going to sell them anything. You know, it's not going to get them more clicks on their articles, and it's not going to get them, you know, more attention to their outlet, because it's not exciting. Yeah. You know, no one wants that. And even as me, and I'm sure, you know, you would agree too, it's still the most fun is watching someone like David Pastrnak go out there and just, you know, tool on other players and score. Mm-hmm. That's the element of hockey that is, you know, most renowned and most regarded. But, you know, I love the details. I love seeing what these players can do at every level. And, you know, I love seeing what someone like, for example, and you know, we saw it with the Bruins last year, they traded Ryan Donato, who was an Arthur Kaliev type. And you know, someone who, in my opinion, is just as highly skilled as he is, for a Johnny Beecher type and Charlie Coyle. Obviously that's more dramatic as they're, you know, in different stages, but the framework of that is similar, and it's just who's going to help your team the most. And it paid off for the Bruins big time then. You know, we'll see what happens with Beecher versus Kaliev.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just for the record, I was a Bobby Brink guy, who, you know, I would have been perfectly happy. I mean, like Bob, like his full name is Bobby Orr Brink. I mean, like come on now, but no, in all sincerity, like I figured it, you know, Brink or Beecher, Beecher fits the mold of what the Bruins, you know, value and what they're comfortable with and what fits best within their culture, their scheme, their way of doing things. And I think, you know, he's going to be a good player. I mean, he, you know, does he have the skill of some of those guys? No. But he also has, I mean, he can really fly down the ice given how big he is. I've seen him. I mean, that guy scored a goal against us a couple of years ago when he was on the under 17 team, and we had a veteran older USHL club and we were playing USA, in Plymouth. And, I remember he took the puck behind the net and he just skated through our whole team and just like a runaway freight train and just went right to the net and he scored. And it was just like, wow. You look at that and you say to yourself, he's going to be able to do that at the higher levels. Now he's going to, as you said, the details, he'll have to learn, how to pick and choose his spots. It's not going to be as easy. But there are some guys that just, they kind of defy logic in terms of their physical package, and the Bruins have done a nice job of assembling, you know, some of these players that fit that mold and that archetype. So it'll be fascinating to see if they can be the player that the Bruins, you know, thought they might be, and when they drafted them where they did, and see where it goes next. And, you know, Beecher's another one of these college guys that the Bruins like to take because the clock is a little longer on them and they can kind of take their time and they're not forced into some of these signing decisions that they have with major junior. And then you have your late bloomers. I mean, they recently signed Nick Wolf and Jack Ashan. What do you know about those guys? And what can you say about Wolf and Ashan in terms of what they bring to the organization?
I think right off the bat, Nick Wolf is already a fan prospect favorite, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
He brings, as you mentioned on Twitter, Kirk, he brings that Adam McQuaid element.
Yeah.
He's a big guy. You know, he's 6'4 plus and 220 pounds, and he's just a monument out there. You know, and I don't mean that in a way that, like, he can't move because he's immobile, because he is mobile. Yeah. Not the best skater, but he's definitely mobile. He can definitely move. You know, I think he's, you know, in that Adam McQuaid mold definitely, but he's mobile. He can keep up with the modern pace of the game so far. We'll see how it, you know, translates to the AHL, where he'll likely start. But he's just someone with great gap control, good positioning, super hard to play against, especially for smaller forwards who are trying to get inside or outside. You know, he's quite good moving, you know, laterally, and not over, you know, spending his energy. So if it's just his range that he uses to keep you outside or, you know, try and force you to one direction, then, yeah, he's got that in spades. So I think he's a, you know, a more modern version of McQuaid. He's not flashy, doesn't really have great puck skills, got a pretty hard shot if he can get it on target. Mm-hmm. Which, again, that also bodes well at the NHL level, because you've got a lot of guys with, you know, world renown and world-class hand-eye coordination. So if you throw on a kind of wild slap shot in there, waist range, and someone tips it, that's going to create some chaos for, you know, opposition. But I digress from that and move forward. And, you know, he obviously isn't exposed to much fighting because, you know, his predominant league is the NCAA, but he craves it. You know, he'd read his quotes and listen to him and talk about fighting and physicality, and, you know, he'll fold you any second he gets. You know, up against the board, he'll just flatten you. He'll take the penalty if it means just absolutely crushing someone. His discipline's good. You know, he's not someone who's out there, you know, throwing reckless hits and reckless checks and using a stick as a weapon. You know, he knows his limits and he knows what he can and can't do, but there is that gamesmanship element, you know. There's that that bit of McQuaid and Chara nastiness to him, where, you know, he'll play on the line and, you know, he'll make that borderline play here and there, even if it does have a poor outcome. And ultimately, if you're a player who's playing against him, you know he's out there. And you see him on the bench and you see him after the whistle, and, you know, your mindset for the game is probably changed because you know he's out there. And it's just a mental aspect in there, because he can back it with the physicality. You know, he can just, like I said, fold you. So I think he's someone that fills that McQuaid-type void, that Kevin Miller-type void possibly, that, you know, has been missed due to injury and just, you know, age and transitioning. But, yeah, I think Nick Wolf is going to be a you know, decent defenseman in the mold of an Adam McQuaid. I don't think he's going to be a first or second pair guy by any means. I think he's, you know, looking like a solid five or six potentially, or you know, even a non-frequent, you know, 7D type guy who, you know, plays 40 to 60 games a year and is just carried as an extra, but, you know, gets in there based on matchup or rest, or, you know, a good versatile utility guy to have who can come in and, you know, just play a solid game each night. And, you know, I think that's similar to McQuaid, but McQuaid obviously had a full-time position carved out in Boston, and it paid off. So, yeah, I really like Nick Wolf, and I think that was a great signing.
Awesome. No, I don't disagree with any of that. Yeah, you know, I've been privy to Wolf, watching him in the NCHC, and he's another team captain. You know, I think you touched on it. It's really about the range. I mean, people, when we talk about skating, you know, everyone getting mobility on a D, sometimes people forget that there's more to it than just the pure edge work, footwork, speed, straight line speed, first step quickness with a defenseman. You talked about Wolf's size. You know, he's almost 6'5". He's got a wingspan of a condor and a long reach. That's part of range, man. And I think he does a really nice, I think he sees the ice pretty well. He may not be an offensive kind of vision, but I think he reads, reacts, processes pretty well. And so he can compensate for the fact that he's maybe, you know, not the most fleet of foot, but that all feeds into the range. He knows how to angle. He knows how to keep guys away, you know, from away from the front of his net, and he knows how to keep himself out of situations where he's going to get burned and there's no one back. You know, I don't see Nick Wolf getting beat back to his own net a whole lot. With him, it's just, he's going to have to control that. You said it, and he doesn't go around like running around, like trying for the big hit. But as a young player without experience, I think he's going to have to learn that he's not going to get away with certain things he could do, you know, in the USHL when he played with Des Moines and then in college, you know, and there are going to be times where he's going to get burned and he's going to have to learn that. But you can't teach a guy, I know it sounds cliched, I've said this numerous times in this podcast alone, but you can't teach, you know, no matter how hard you work, you know, and we'll talk about Jack Ashon here in a second, but no matter how hard Jack Ashon hits the bench or the weight room, you know, and gets on the bench and tries to throw the weight up, he's never going to be 6'5", 220, 230 pounds. It's just not going to happen. So, yeah, Bruins fans, I think some of the excitement's a little over the top, but I love to see it, you know, and if Wolf can become a fan favorite, much like McQuaid was, more power to him, because he is naturally nasty. And, you know, there's a lot of gentle giants out there in high levels of hockey. And so when you have a guy that's big and genuinely tough and nasty like Wolf is, and the way McQuaid was, you know, nicest guy off the ice. But it's like you get on the ice and, you know, someone flips a switch and they just want to kill you. There's something to be said for that. So, you know, Bruins stayed in Minnesota and announced another, you know, pretty big. I don't think people realize kind of how big the Ashon signing could be for Boston. It's really a brilliant example of understanding the value of college free agents and then scooping some pretty good teams who had Ashon out to their development camps to actually land him, and leveraging existing relationships between players and coaches and people in Minnesota and all the connections that we've seen from the stories that have come out. So interested in your take on Ashon and what he means for the Bruins.
Yeah, I mean, he's a player that, you know, first of all, Jack Ashon should have been drafted, right? And he's someone that definitely slipped through the cracks, and that's probably going to be felt for a lot of teams out there. Right off the bat, he's now one of the top skaters in the organization for the Bruins.
Yep.
I mean, he's just dynamic, right? And every way you cut it, you know, he can skate. And I liken him to a Matt Grizzly type. Very fleet-footed, very light, but, you know, skates with conviction. You know, he's not someone that's easily going to get knocked off the puck, despite being, you know, small. You know, he's someone that will actually be able to, you know, stand up bigger players, you know, stand you up and absorb your hit and kind of use that really strong lower half and good edge work to, you know, stand players up. And I think that, you know, you look at him and what he can bring. He's the perfect modern defenseman right now, moving into the, you know, modern day NHL as it keeps, you know, changing and moving and, you know, everything like that. So I think his ability to control the game with the puck on a stick is also extremely high end, and it's not talked about enough right now. And he's a new prospect, so I don't expect a lot of people to, you know, really have a good read on him yet. But, you know, he can pick you apart from anywhere on the ice passing that puck. And I'm sure you've seen it multiple times, you know, throughout his career, but, you know, he'll take you, you know, for your money, and he'll start skating from his own end and, you know, move up the ice. And the second you think you're going to close on him, he'll either shift around you or he'll just deliver a tape-to-tape bullet pass from, you know, 50 to 60 feet out. Nothing's off the table with that kid. And I'm excited for him because, you know, this and people bring up Torey Krug a lot, and they bring up Matt Grizzlick a lot, even though, you know, Grizzlick was drafted and Krug was signed. But I think you're looking at, you know, someone who is quite as talented and skilled as Torey Krug was at this time in his career. So, you know, I think something
skater.
That
he's a better skater.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Without even and that's what I was going to say, you know, without even questioning it, you know, you look at Krug and you know, he's built like a log. Mm-hmm. You know, he's built like a stump. You know, he's shorter. He's obviously athletic, but he's got big, big legs, and, you know, he really draws power from that, and he's got more of a power stride than a fleet-footed stride. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ashon has this more kind of high-end, like almost first-round NHL prospect kind of talent where he can kind of shift in and out and be a dynamic skater, pivot and change direction and tempo at will. Yep. So I think based on those attributes alone, he will absolutely be a serviceable, you know, defenseman. And I think at the next level, his potential is that of a, you know, second pair guy who can, you know, be a Torrey Krug light, Matt Grizzly hybrid type player like that.
Yes. Hi. I was going there. You took it. You took the words right out of my, he is a hybrid. He plays with jam and intensity. You know, as much as we like Matt Grizzly, I mean, I don't think, you know, even the most ardent Grizzly supporters are going to concede he doesn't have a lot of jam, but what he does really well. Right. Krug is the jam. He's the chip on your shoulder. I'm going to beat you because, you know, my whole life people have thought I can't do this and I'm pissed off and he plays perpetually pissed off, but he's an absolute power play weapon. Right. And that's how he's established himself, because he's smarter, he's more driven, and pound for pound, even though he's undersized, he's so strong and he catches guys off guard and because they go in to take him out, and he's either braced for the contact and gets up under them, or he's anticipated their angle and he's not there when they go to finish him. And just a tremendous, you know, vision passer. I mean, you know, I'm a huge Torrey Krug guy, as you can imagine. But what I really like about Ashan is that he's kind of a hybrid, you know, whereas the Grizzlick's elite in retrieval, he's a breakout machine. You know, he's an absolute spark plug for the transition game. That's the stuff Ashan does. So if you can take the best attributes of both of those guys and put them into one player, now he's got to go out and do it, right? But it's a nice, as you said, free, you know, without having to expend assets in the form of draft picks or prospects. It's a free kick at the can and potentially a meatball served over the plate for a potential home run for Don Sweeney and his staff.
Absolutely. And, you know, he's just another one of those character type kids too, you know.
Yep.
And
winner.
He's a winner. And, you know, like you said earlier, it sounds cliche, and as we divulge into, you know, analytics further in the NHL and hockey at all levels, people don't really want to hear those. You know, it's often returned to as or referred to as, you know, some kind of old mentality or, you know, old boys club type train of thoughts where, you know, and the Bruins get criticized for it too. But you know what? They're picking the guys who aren't just, you know, leaders and intangible, you know, ownership and stuff like that. They're people who are also highly skilled. And Ashan is one of those people that I think fans and media should be extremely excited for.
Awesome. Now, Dom was just curious about, you know, where you think Cooper Zach is and does, you know, whether Ashan's signing is going to impact him at all.
So that's an interesting one, because obviously Cooper Zach was someone signed with the same elements or similar elements out of Ferris State that Ashan had. And that was only, you know, a year ago that we're looking at that. And, you know, I think Cooper Zach has made some really good progress as a prospect in Providence. You know, he came in for a few games when he was signed and you could see it. You know, he had those Ashan elements. I think that it could potentially be another scenario, though, where we're looking at like a Grizzly and Krug type vibe, where one doesn't necessarily displace the other. Although these two players, I think, are more similar than Krug and Grizzly are, because I don't think those two players are really similar at all besides their size. But, you know, I think that Ashan does everything with much more conviction and meaning, whereas Zach is much more creative and fluid and kind of adjusting on the fly out there. He doesn't cover his own zone as well as Ashan, because he doesn't have that, you know, strength and just kind of density that he has. I think that's a good word to liken both of them. Ashan, although he's similar in size and even a bit smaller, is just far more dense than Zach is, and he plays much harder. So I think Zach is another super you know, skilled guy, and he's also someone that, you know, you're looking to as a fan or writer or analyst, and you're saying, wow, you know what, this kid's got it. You can see that he thinks the game at a high level, and he's kind of like a, you know, stud in the making there. I will say that sometimes Zek definitely gets the best of himself in his own zone, which is where I don't think Ashaan does. I think Ashaan's always nails, like always. You know, Zek a few times at Providence has, you know, sat a couple stretches because, you know, he wasn't as hard on the puck as he should be, or, you know, he's trying to take the puck too far back and reset and then go on the attack like you would be able to do, you know, in the lower ranks such as the NCAA or juniors. So I think that's just progress for him, and that's just something that he has to work on moving forward. But I don't necessarily think that, you know, there's any writing on the wall for, you know, any player such as Zek because Ashaan was signed. But I do think that this just gives the Bruins, you know, more ammo in the warehouse. You know, and I think down the road if you get Ashaan, you know, obviously he's on a good contract right now with Boston. But if you get Zek signed to a NHL deal, a two-way good deal, and, you know, you can keep him there because he's still on his AHL deal, you might have more ammo to work with to swing a deal for, you know, another prospect or another roster player in part of a package that can just, you know, help you for essentially free, because you sign these guys for free. That's what it comes down to. And if you can get good serviceable players out of both of them, awesome. If they both play for your organization, even better. But if one of them turns out to be an attractive object to another team and they have something you need or you want, perfect. That's what it's all about, right? Building your team, building your roster, constructing it the way you want, but also in your parameters. The ball's in your court. And Boston, when they keep signing guys like Zek and Ashaan, the ball keeps being in their court.
Yeah, that's great. Great. Well, you know, we're over 2 hours, but I do want to, you know, we've talked about a lot of guys that are really well known in the organization. Give me one player that you think is under the radar, you know, Boston Bruins prospect that doesn't, that you know, doesn't get a lot of attention on the message boards, and is maybe not in the forefront of a lot of fans' knowledge of the team, or, you know, not a player that's kind of a household name or off the tip of the tongue. Who is your passion favorite prospect right now that no one's really talking about very much?
Victor Berglund.
Okay.
He is someone that I have, along with Cameron Hughes, but he's kind of on the radar, kind of not. Yeah. But completely off the radar, Victor Berglund. You know, this is someone who was, again, one of those players in one of those recent drafts where European scouts and scouts at the Bruins table were allegedly pounding the table for. I think that was the quote used.
Yeah, PJ Axelson, specifically.
You know, You look at someone like Berglund, and, you know, I could see why he's not on the radar. He's a stick. You know, he's a string bean. He's got the body type of Gumby. And he's tall. He's slender, lanky. He's got to weigh maybe 160 pounds. And for some reason, he's still super strong on his feet. And, you know, you watch him for Modo of, you know, Allsvenskan, and he gets the job done. It's the best part about him. And he came in, you know, after, you know, last year he came to Providence, played a few games, and we saw it. He hops off the bench. He skates with speed and authority into the you know, attacking zone, gets a loose puck, rips it, and just scores. He has those, you know, Erik Karlsson-like natural talent abilities where he can kind of pick up a loose puck and just rip it, and it's on target and hard always. You know, it's destined for top shelf or, you know, mid-range to the goalie in an area that's hard to cover from certain angles. And whether he's getting the puck at the board or getting the puck at the you know, blue line, if he just rips a wrister, it is rising and it is going just straight on target every time. Unfortunately, he doesn't have the exposure to, you know, media analysts and writers and anyone out there, you know, mainly on Twitter and other realms of the internet, because he plays in a kind of overshadowed league by, you know, the SHL in that corner of the world. But he is super skilled, and I think that, you know, he's still obviously young enough to make an impact anywhere, really. So it just came out recently that he signed a 2-year deal with Luleå of the SHL. Mm-hmm. And I think that's tremendous for his next step, because getting him into the more refined professional hockey leagues where talent is hard and you know, they're harder to play against and, you know, they're just more dense players is going to be great for him. But I think they might actually have something with him there. And that's not just saying something to be different, but I mean, his skill is pretty high end, I'd say. I mean, you know, he can skate well, he can cover the ice pretty well, although he doesn't have the strength for it. But I think the only thing keeping him out of an NHL modern day defensive future is his strength and his physical attributes. You know, if he can overpower those and maybe bulk up a little or, you know, carve out, you know, kind of one of those, Elias Pettersson type roles where, yeah, you are kind of a lankier, slimmer type build, but you're just strong and you're so talented it doesn't matter, then he's going to be able to do that. And I talked to him a couple times last year around Providence when he was here. He said he personally likens his game to Erik Karlsson. That's who he idolizes. And, hey, if you got someone like that who's skilled enough to play, you know, in those rankings right now like that player, roll with him, let him see what he can do, and, you know, kind of just watch him for fun. And if he pans out, he pans out. But right now I think he's a diamond in the rough type caliber prospect for the Bruins.
Sounds great. I know very little about him, so I learned something. My guy is Quinn Olson, 92nd overall pick, third round last year, out of the Okotoks Oilers of the Alberta Junior League. I mean, this kid is a Boston Bruin type player, all, you know, stamped all over him. Just finished his freshman year at Minnesota Duluth with Nick Wolf as his captain. Didn't play much, played sparingly as a true freshman. Had 2 years in the AJ and was a productive player. Probably could have played another year of junior. Probably would have gone on to the USHL, to be completely honest. I think Sioux City had his rights, but Duluth does a really good job of recruiting, and Scott Sandelin and Herter and those coaches there at the Bulldogs, I mean, they're not back-to-back champions, and there for a third year, because as people may forget, they lost to Denver 3 years ago in the Frozen Four championship game. So 3 years in a row to the championship game, they've won the last two. It's not an accident. They do things right. I think he's getting great development. He can skate. He can score. He's gritty. He doesn't have a lot of size, but he's another, like, you know, similar to a Carson Kuhlman type of player.
Exactly.
Only he's higher end, right? He's higher end. So, That's my guy. I don't think people talk enough about Quinn Olson, and yeah, they will soon. He's going to take. I think he'll take a big step. Next season, at Duluth, now with a year under his belt, and he's probably going to play two more years there. So it's going to be interesting to see how he develops. I think he's going to be one of these guys that's going to appear on a lot of underrated lists going forward. So great. As this, again, this interview's gone over 2 hours. I love it. Really appreciate your time. But I told you this when I first got you on the phone. We are whiskey connoisseurs, and so cannot let you go without having a little bit of non-hockey talk. And so I'm just genuinely curious. For people who don't know, Anthony and I both enjoy the finer things, and bourbon whiskey is some of our favorite, and we agree on a lot of the certainly our palate. So what is on the tasting list and of your favorite pours right now, Anthony? Because it's been a while since we've talked whiskey.
Yeah, so as you know, Kirk, and I'll tell everyone else who's listening right now, I'm a big Buffalo Trace Distillery guy. I think they make the best bourbon, hands down, across every single product that comes out of their distillery. Blanton's is my absolute favorite, and as Kirk mentioned earlier on, I do have a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle, a 12-year bottle. And I love it, don't get me wrong. But if I could drink one blindly and compare it to another, it would be Blanton's. And I don't even know if I'd be able to tell like a big difference between the two. Love Blanton's, also getting very hard to find. So I shipped the Buffalo Trace, just plain old Buffalo Trace. Yes, it's not as sexy as Blanton's. The bottle's not as cool. John Wick doesn't drink it as he's beating people up. But it is, if you put it in a glass next to Blanton's, you put a blindfold on and you drink both, or if I pour a Buffalo Trace into Blanton's and pour it to you, I don't think the regular person would be able to tell the difference for $28 versus $60, and obviously it's super hard to find. Another one that I love is Michter's regular Kentucky Straight Bourbon. Love it. Getting a little bit harder to find, more on the pricey side, but I know that Kirk's a Weller kind of fan, and also has a bottle of Michter's that I believe he said he was saving for a special occasion.
Yeah, I didn't tell you. Yeah, I didn't tell you what it what I yeah, I've actually I have got a thing called I started dabbling in the barrel. Now barrel is sourced bourbon, right? So for those who maybe don't know what that means, they don't have their own distillery yet. Now they are standing up their own distillation capabilities. Unfortunately, that is a time process, so you can't just, you can't just do it overnight and start producing your own whiskey. They're probably looking at another 5 to 7 years before they get that off the ground. So in the meantime, what they do is they take bourbon from other sources that's distilled elsewhere, and then they modify it. They age it, they finish it, they do a variety of things, and I like their product. It's nice. It is, price point isn't ideal, but if you can find the good stuff, they have something called Barrel Craft Spirits Bourbon, which is a high end line, and really nice. I had a chance to sample some and didn't have to pay the premium, MSRP for the bottle, but saving that for a rainy day. I'm with you on Buffalo Trace. I'm a fan of the E.H. Taylor, the Colonel Taylor line, Eagle Rare. I like more as a mixer versus, if I'm sipping, neat, then I'm all about Blanton's all day long. It is one of my favorites as well, but I like Taylor single barrel, and then, like I said, Eagle Rare is fine. I just prefer to mix it. And then I'm with you. You can't really go wrong with just the regular Buffalo Trace. I mean, it's kind of like when people talk about Maker's Mark, and it's just kind of like a standard pour, like if you're somewhere, everyone kind of has it, and it's nice. It's never going to steer you wrong. Right. So, but we have that in common. I am a Michter's guy. I also like the Henry McKenna 10-year bottled in bond, just because, it's hard to get those age statements and a bottled in bond, bourbon. So, I unfortunately, Henry McKenna winning the World Whiskey Award gold medal kind of, upped it. Like the price jumped, about $20 on a bottle of Henry McKenna from what it used to be. So that's the big thing. I think the key thing for us, Anthony, is we've got to find what that next big whiskey is going to be and buy it before it gets, before it gets accolades and wins these competitions. Because the second it does, boy, the price on these things just shoot up. And that's just that's life. That's part of it, right?
Yeah, I think to your point there, I think Michter's might be that next kind of really out there bottle that people are really, really, seeking. Obviously, the production has to be ramped up as well, but I think that's going to be one that once people start tasting it, because I think that's kind of similar to Blanton's for me personally anyways.
Yeah.
So, and it's available right now. I think you had said a couple months ago when we were talking about it that it's tough to find where you are, but around here, it's more prevalent. But yeah, I've also been drinking a lot of the Japanese stuff, and I know we've talked about that. Mm-hmm. And Nika Coffee Grain is outstanding, I think.
Okay.
I think anything that comes out of Nika is awesome. Nika Straight from the Barrel, I think, was the 2018 Whiskey of the Year. A little tough to find, especially since that specific distiller, Nika in Japan, had stopped production of a lot of that stuff because of supply and demand. So there's definitely going to be a shortage of that. If anyone's listening and loves bourbon, anytime you see anything from Nika, buy it when you get a chance. Same thing with Hibiki. They're a bit more pricey, but the stories, I just love the stories about that stuff, and I think Japanese culture is really enriched with, stories and tales and craftsmanship and details, and I just can't get enough of it. And, another quick thing here for anyone listening, Kirk earlier mentioned that E.H. Taylor out of the Buffalo Trace Distillery is one of his favorites. another cool story about that is there's another version of that same whiskey slash bourbon. But the difference is it's a purple bottle. The label's purple and the artwork's purple instead of yellow. And that's called their Tornado Survivor Series. It's one of the rarest bourbons you can find because it's so finite. But the story is a tornado ripped through one of their warehouses where all that stuff was being distilled. And some of the ricks, you know, the barrels survived. Mm-hmm. And when they got, you know, tossed around from the elements, they allegedly, you know, released all sorts of different, you know, flavors and, you know, profiles and notes allegedly. And it was bottled as such and sold as a, you know, special run. Kind of like how...
Emphasis on the word allegedly. It's kind of like the Jefferson's Ocean concept.
That's what I took it out of my mouth, man. Ugh. I just said like... Damn. But yeah, that's, you know, it's just one of those cool things about bourbon. And I think that's ultimately, you know, why I love it. And also why I love wine is, you know, you sit down with your buddies or family or, you know, significant others. And, you know, you talk about the stories and how we all got here and how, you know, the product in front of you got there. So love bourbon. Kirk obviously loves it as well. And that's been one of our off hockey, you know, conversation points for couple of years now, thankfully.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by the whole process. I mean, you know, wine is one thing. You can envision how, you know, wine came into being, you know, in terms of fermentation of grapes and all of that. But whiskey, that is a complex process. And whoever figured out how to do that, I mean, and there's a lot of different ideas and theories out there. But in the end, you know, there was some really enterprising people from the Isle there across the ocean that came up with a process that just fascinates me in its complexity and the different flavor profiles and how you're just able to create that kind of a product that just has a world of possibilities behind it. And so anyway, for those of you that are into hockey, you're probably not digging the whiskey talk, but I tell you, my time in the military, whiskey and cigars was a big part of the cavalry lifestyle. And that's what I grew up with. So it's nice to kind of carry that over. Anthony, I want to thank you so much for your time, your insights, your knowledge. I want to thank you for your kind words too up front. I mean, I do this because I love it. I don't make a dime off the blog. That's never been my intention. I just, you know, I like to talk hockey and I like to share, you know, insights and nuggets and things. And my job in the USHL with the Omaha Lancers kind of prevents me from doing that because I have to give them my, you know, my full attention. And during the season, I'm here, I'm there. And the blog, unfortunately, takes a back seat. So now with a little more time on my hands than I'm used to, it's exciting to be able to do some more on that and bring people in like yourself that are going to just broaden the horizon. So I appreciate the kind words about my influence, but really, you've done great work to kind of create your own brand and your own perspectives. And I think, you know, if you're not following at Bruins Network on Twitter, what are you waiting for? Get on it. If you're a Bruins fan, if you're a hockey fan in general, because again, Anthony's insights, if you haven't figured it out on the podcast in this interview we've done, you know, he's thinking like a hockey guy. He's not impressed with the shiny objects as much as he's looking at details and he's looking at the right kind of players. And I can't stress that enough. So Anthony, hats off to you. Again, I thank you for coming on and joining us today.
Thank you, Kirk, for everything. Obviously, you know, the kind words there carry a lot of weight coming from you in this, you know, publication/blog/outlet or whatever we're classifying this as. But thank you very much for having me, and I would love to come back anytime. But thanks, and for anyone listening that follows me, thank you as well. I appreciate each and every one of you.
Awesome. Okay, well, for the Scouting Post, this is a wrap of 2 hours and about little under 2 hours and 25 minutes of hockey and a little bourbon talk at the end. But thank you for joining us if you're still here. For the Scouting Post, this is Kirk Ludeke with Anthony Kwiatkowski of Bruins Network. Hang tough. You know, these times will pass. Everything we're dealing with COVID-19, you know, use common sense. You know, don't put yourself in danger. Don't put others in danger. We have a great country. We're going to get through it. And things will change for the better. I believe that. You believe that. We just got to stay strong and hang in there. And for the people that are hurting, we hear you. So if this podcast can in any way distract you from some of the critical decisions and the tough things that you're facing in your life right now, then we're glad to do so. You know, we're all on the same team, we're all in the same boat, and we will, this too will pass. So for Scouting Post, Kirk Ludeke, we're out of here. Thanks for listening. Ciao.